Hi, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Olivia.
Hi, I'm Jesse.
And I'm Andy.
And this episode, delayed for 2.5 months, we are finally doing our 100th episode review of Star Trek Picard Season 3 and asking, is it going to make us quit Star Trek?
John, the issue is not Star Trek today.
Olivia,
The issue.
just
Yeah, you do need that. The issue is, do you value our friendship? It
not.
is March 8th, International Women's Day. And what have you done to me? You've made me watch Picard. Are you an ally or are you not?
Quite clearly an enemy.
This is so
We've been over
fucked.
this.
This is the
Just
end.
what better way to celebrate International Women's Day than watching a season of television where every single woman and women's relationship has to do with male trauma and just making the men feel sad.
We
Well,
have to
And also
celebrate.
killing them.
And also
Yeah,
killing
and
them for no
killing,
reason.
can't forget killing them. That is true.
Fellas, is it feminist to blow up your strong female characters?
They can take it.
Look, they intended to bring her back. They sent a resurrector at the end. They just forgot to get around to it because it didn't fit in the season. So, I mean, it's
Ro
fine.
Laren
Let's make
died
some
on the
fun.
way back to her home planet.
It's like the ending of Quantum Leap. Like, Ro Laren never made it home.
She was on a rare replacement bus. So it has been, well, it's basically been a year since Picard came out. It's nearly been a year since it ended.
You might even say, John, it's been a long time getting
But
from
our
there to here.
time
Yeah.
is finally here. Andy,
Good
you're done. We started off so strong, but
night,
references to
everybody.
Enterprise, it's over.
But, and you know, Picard, people liked Star Trek Picard. The Rotten Tomatoes, 98% from the critics,
What?
89% from the audience.
This is
Wait,
bullshit. They're all just fucking nerds.
yeah,
Is
as you may.
my review of Picard on there? I think I actually put it as a not rotten. But it was, I should
It
put
was
cheese
like,
to rotten.
I
Because
guess.
I
Let me have a look.
know I put it on there.
Is it critic? Yes, you gave it a not rotten. You gave it a you, wow.
Did I say? What did I say? I was thinking I was being very kind at the time. What did I say? I'm trying to
Well,
remember.
9 out of 10 best Star Trek ever, I think you said.
While
Yeah.
the
Yeah. Finally
season
returned to form.
provides excellent reunions and nostalgic moments, it also serves as a reminder of the missteps of 90s era Star Trek that other modern Trek series have moved past. It's a
Huh.
bittersweet goodbye, but a necessary one for Star Trek to move forward.
That was basically my feeling. It's just like, I'm glad we're done with this. Here's the
I'm
vibe
glad
I'm trying to
we
get
can
through.
let Patrick Stewart rest. Can
Having
we? Are we? We're not even.
No, because he wants to do a
I
fucking film.
was gonna say, having read his autobiography, I've got to say this narrative that Picard is the victim here, is the prisoner, I think needs reevaluating because he's actually he's responsible for a lot of this.
He's obsessed. He
No, it's
needs
all
to go
very
to
simple.
bed.
I think Patrick Stewart ran over a child in 1993 somewhere in Hollywood. And for the last 30 years, he's been paying off whatever producer saw him do that. And the money, the amount of monthly payments just keep going up and up and up. It's quite clear, it's either blackmail or he wants to die on stage.
Does
Yeah, I
he
mean,
like
well,
his wife?
is he married?
yes.
Oh
Oh
yeah,
yeah,
Ian
the
McKellen doesn't count.
No, the lady, I forget her name, but the lady who was in Stretch Picard season two, remember that episode where they just go to a club and then like Seven of Nine or like the Borg Queen or something like smashes a window and then Seven and Raffi show up and they're just like, oh, look, this must be the way the Borg Queen went. Like that episode. If forgive me if you don't remember it, because it was Stretch Picard season two, and I there's
You
like
know,
90% of that season
I
nothing
think I know what you're
happened.
talking about. Yeah.
But that lady, there's like a scene there where like a lady is singing. That is Picard's or Picard's that is Patrick Stewart's wife. So
I'm
like there's
supposed
just
to
a scene that
believe
just
Patrick Stewart
exists.
met his wife in the club.
No, like they apparently like she's like 30 years younger than he is, and like she
Sunny
just
Ozell is the name of
yeah.
the lady.
Yeah, and she's just in a scene in a Picard season two just because like, oh look, it's Patrick Stewart's wife. Well, she
Slay.
was meant to be in the end of it as well, but we can
Oh.
probably get into things which people would like to have added to Star Trek later on. We have many thoughts on those, don't we, Jesse?
We do, we do.
So, Olivia, you having, I've not asked you what you thought of Picard season three. I'm just going to let you watch it while I erase this.
You haven't asked me? We've gone through this. The pain that it's caused me, the devastation.
No, we've not, actually. You just tell me you're in pain, I go, right, and move on. But now I'm asking, what are your full thoughts?
I was waiting for Picard to give me what I wanted. I stuck through it, season one and season two. Yeah, I complained. But I was like, oh, I'll see my besties. Elnor will grow. He'll be a cute little character that I'll see again. What a fucking fool I was. I was given nothing. I was given no continuity.
You want to know something worse? What? They blew him up.
They thrust season 8 of TNG upon me. I did not want it. It was not enough time has passed. I'm not nostalgic for it. And I do not care about the bald Shakespearean man.
They task me and I shall have them.
Olivia, you say this about the bald Shakespearean man. What about his vaguely, like, Kendall son?
His son, another boring man. But that's, you know, natural. Because, you know,
Aragon, you
genetics.
Know.
Yeah.
I felt like I was cheated of a Star Trek series that they never really committed to. And then I was already put in a sort of, it put a sour taste in my mouth for accepting this season three reunion, which I personally didn't ask for. But the people from the 80s loved it.
The people from the 80s.
As a person from the 80s, I take issue with that.
I still stand by Olivia. I think we said this before we were recording, but like, if you actually want the show Star Trek Picard should have been, read the novels. They are actually everything that I wanted from a Star Trek Picard show, and it's excellent. And the only thing that good that came out of Star Trek Picard, I think.
See, my real question is, I just want to know, did David Mack go to a gay club to figure out what the vibe, or did he just send someone on a fact-finding mission? Because I know very little about David Mack, but the image of him just standing in the middle of, like, heaven or something, being like, with a note back out going, Yes.
I mean, I joke about the Seven of Nine Queer Club book, but it's actually very good. But then the better ones are Una McCormick's novels, which are like actually like discussions of like the geopolitics of a Federation post Dominion War. And I'm like, I'm here for all of that. But that's just Una McCormick generally. So
yeah, I hope she's. Doing
anyways,
well.
Wait, does Una McCormick have gay club scenes as well?
No, she but
wrote,
she does
quite
have
a lot of Garak, so
yeah, she did write up Garak. There's a Star Trek Picard novel that's Raffi and Garak and Elnor, and it's actually fantastic.
I'm just trying to decide if I need to take Una McCormack to Dalston Superstore. That one was for the gays. The London gays.
You'll get Una McCormack into Dalston Superstore before you get me into Dalston Superstore. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. This is a genuine plea. John has to go to Dalston Superstore or I quit the podcast.
No.
It will happen, don't worry, guys.
Only if you go to RAF Duxford.
I'll go. Love the Lancaster.
Anyway, so for the record, I watched Picard season three through the press readers for Trekcore. Shout out to Trekcore, who let me write Strange Worlds reviews even when I don't enjoy a lot of it. But I remember watching episode 1 to 4. In a block, because he sent us out in a block. And I remember watching that and thinking, that was fab. They know what they're doing. And then waking up in the morning and going, did they just do Mutara Nebula again? And then watching it and going, they just did Mutara Nebula, but longer and less interesting.
Okay, and for the non-nerd nerds, who the hell is that? What the hell is that?
Wrath of Khan, the Battle of Wrath of Khan.
I mean, the season literally starts with somewhere in the 25th century. It's literally just pulling right from Wrath of Khan.
In the same font. In the exact same font.
Mm-hmm.
So, but also what strikes me is that is the Mutara Nebula thing and then the aliens at the end strikes me that with my overarching issues, which is that there's the callbacks are shit and then they miss the better ones.
Yeah. Those
jellyfish aliens should have been the jellyfish aliens from Encounter at Farpoint.
Right? I was thinking that exact same thing. That would have been actually a decent, like, oh, look, it's going back to the beginning. And like, okay. I want to give Olivia a rant. I've ranted enough on my own end, so I'll give Olivia the rant.
The rant? I would love to hear it.
Oh, my rant is just like my overall frustration with this season is that it's so much nostalgia And there are kernels of very good ideas here, like the changelings being in it, where it's like, oh, you have a rogue group of changelings who are actually dealing with PTSD from the Dominion War and like dealing with like them having been literally subject to war crimes. And then the season just ignores those interesting ideas to just do the thing that we've already seen before in other Star Trek shows again and just make nostalgia play. So it's like the shapeshifters are doing what they were doing in Paradise Lost, or not Paradise Lost, the Homefront.
That was Paradise Lost.
Whose fault is this? Fear? I don't know, fear in writing. Like, is it a boardroom of nerds that are just like, no, you must stick to the script?
We could say it's a boardroom, but it there's one man who tagged his name to this vision constantly in a desperate attempt to get work. I mean, in a desperate and increasingly vain attempt to get work. So, like,
and to be loved. To be loved, John.
John, who are you coming for?
His name
Sharpen your bitch blade. Sharpen your bitch blade, John.
He shall remain nameless because he's nice.
I want to start a rap star beef with the Star Trek writing room.
I think the problem is, like, I think, John, you and I talked about this when we were at Star Trek Las Vegas, but it is the fact that when people get Star Trek nowadays, and it's not just exclusive to Picard, though I think Picard is the worst version of this, especially in season three, but it's like they are fans of science fiction and not the stories or the history that science fiction is based on. So like you look at Strange New Worlds and you'll get like, oh, the Gorn are just xenomorphs because they like aliens, without like recognizing the like discussion of sexual body politics that aliens is discussing, and also the anti-capitalism that aliens is discussing. It's just like, no, Gorn equals xenomorph now because we like that. And then with Star Trek Picard season three, it is just, they are all fans of Star Trek. So all the references are just to other Star Treks and just pulling from other Star Treks of like, what's the other cool thing that we can reference, instead of like actually using these parts of Star Trek to point at what those original things were about. And it ultimately just makes it just a nostalgia play, which is so frustrating because there are kernels of really cool stuff here that I really do like, but they don't ultimately go anywhere and are just like, hey, there's that thing that you liked, doing it again.
Yeah, I struggle within Star Trek Season 3, the more I think about, to find anything that felt like something that Star Trek hadn't had a go at before.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have time, John. They had already done the first two seasons for a money laundering scheme to fund the third. And they didn't have time to be thinking about how to make it an actually good series. They were stressed. They got Patrick on board, they got the crew on board, and they panicked.
Yeah, that's, and you were talking to Olivia, like, it's so frustrating because seasons one and two, especially season one, has good ideas that I'm like, that I want to know more about that. And then it becomes like just, oh, look, we can have our big explosive 1,000 ships showing up, copy and paste fleet to do like a big explosion at the end. When it's like, oh man, like, why? I would love to see the extrapolation of like synthetic, anti-synthetic sentiment within the Federation, and like what that means politically, and like dive into that. But it's like, no, we'll just wrap that up in a nice bow because Patrick Stewart like stopped them from blowing everyone up with the Eldritor octopus monsters from outside of time, and it's all fine now.
I mean, one of the big issues with Picard season three is it completely goes out of its way to pretend seasons one and two just did not exist.
Exactly,
I mean,
I think I can count
the direct references to the first two seasons on a single hand. And I do wonder, would Picard season three have been better if seasons one and two had not existed? Because then we're not feeling the loss of those other seasons. I mean, if this was the first time we'd revisited these characters in this world since Nemesis, I'd be a lot more forgiving of it, because we're like, oh, cool, we're going to see the Borg for the first time in, you know, however many years. Not like, oh, third time in as many seasons, eh? Mm.
Yeah, but okay, the problem, if my choice is Picard season three and just that, or Picard season one and just that, I choose Picard season one and just that.
Mm. Yeah, me too.
Because it's just fundamentally trying to do more interesting things. It doesn't bung. It bungs at the end. You know what? Mm-hmm. Endings are fucking hard.
They really are. Well, the endings are hard.
What are you going
also
through right now? What are you writing? That came from your soul.
All I'm saying is it's a firing squad involved.
Yeah. But I mean, I'll say, look, so Picard season one, I honestly believe if they had ended season one with Picard's death, I think that would have been, you know, there were issues with that season as a whole, but overall as a narrative, I think that works. That's kind of a culmination of Picard's story, and, you know, one and done. It wouldn't have gone down as the all-time greatest bit of Star Trek, but, you know, as a revisit of that era and that world, that would have been interesting. But then there was Picard season two, which was just such a hot mess, and it really just didn't know what it was trying to be. And then you get to season three, and it's fan fiction. It's pure fan fiction. And I say this as someone who has written a lot of fan fiction. I've written a bit of fan fiction.
We can all see your wall, Andy. Well, not the audience, but...
yeah. You can't see that, though, because that doesn't exist. But my point is, the Picard season three is very much a case of someone who is passionate about Star Trek, which is fair enough, you know, who was involved in the production and has been given the keys to make their fan fiction canon. And all of the crazy batshit things they want to do, they've been allowed to do it. And they've gone wild. They've been given too much sugar, and now they've just run around the candy store and they need to have a nap.
You know,
you reminded me of one of my main issues with Picard, which is, why won't we let him die? Why won't we let him die? He is now a cyborg who cannot die and has cheated death.
Has cheated death three times. That's even Kirk did. Kirk has never actually died and come back to life.
He just cheats God. It's a different thing.
And then we know his body still exists as well. His body's still in Daystrom, isn't it?
I hate it.
So that we can possibly bring him back at any point. Like, it's this inability, because it's a franchise, this inability to let Star Trek actually be something other than Star Trek TM trademark. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the inability for the franchise to try and push forward and be like, what can Star Trek do that's new? It has to always be, how can we resell you Star Trek again in a new package? And it's why I miss, like, the era of Deep Space Nine, where it's like, this is just something weird and doing something very different, and yet it's commenting on Star Trek in a new way. And then this feels like just the era of, like, Voyager and Enterprise, where it's just TNG light and all the interesting ideas that Voyager and Enterprise had peek through, and you get, like, little interesting episodes or moments here and there, but then you're just mainly, for the most of it, just getting Next Generation light. And that's what this season is as well. And it's not actually developing things. Like, I think, Andy, you, like, I showed you my, and John, I think I showed you this too, my Ferengi thing about Deep Space Nine that I wrote. And one of the things that I was like, as I wrote that, I found, I'm like, oh, connecting it to Picard season three, where you have, this is just a minor example, I think the larger problem, whereas you have Sneed, which, by the way, great, great Ferengi name. I do appreciate the Sneed Ferengi name. But the problem with Sneed is, like, he's just a Ferengi gangster that's just there, and he's just being like criminal boss man, and there's no actual sense of how the Ferengi even were used in the Next Generation, which was very terribly, but like comedically talking about capitalism and sort of like a neoliberal mindset of like the Reagan era economics. And then like Deep Space Nine evolved that into being a much more nuanced look at how like individuals live within a sort of neoliberal system. But then you bring it to Sneed and Picard, and it's just like, look, he's a gangster. We're not even going to like, he doesn't even, that character just exists to just be a Ferengi and like, hey, look, there's a Ferengi back in Picard, as opposed to there being like, let's use the Ferengi to talk about capitalism, neoliberalism, or like how that exists within the Federation. Like, it's just, he's just there as a reference, as opposed to like using them for what they're actually supposed to be. And that is the entire problem with across the board, where it's like the shapeshifters are here just to be the shapeshifters again. The Borg are here just to be the Borg again, but we'll add like weird mommy trauma to the Borg because the weird through line of sexism that goes throughout the season.
Just want to be relatable to the people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I just realized annoys the fuck out of me that like I didn't realize annoyed me? The concept, like, it's quite Metalis Prime, right? They're quite clearly trying to create this space. They're trying to do Free Cloud again, which just do fucking Free Cloud, because I like the idea that a bunch of whack job libertarians fucked off the planet and made it work by just creating a monopoly of violence. But they're trying to make Metalis as this like space Hong Kong, space Shanghai, gray zone of authority where the Federation has authority and like everyone has vague areas of authority, but it's still kind of a criminal mess. And they just don't commit to it because it's not a place that matters in terms of the plot. Like, think, what was the name of the Romulan refugee planet in season one of Picard?
I know what you're talking about.
Vashti. No. Yeah.
I will look it up. You keep going.
Let's call it Planet Bob.
Planet Bob. But that planet mattered because it existed because of a key plot point in Picard. and the post-Nemesis era, which is the collapse of the Roman Empire, right? It existed because of events that happened, and its nature, it being a dilapidated dust bowl, is important to the plot.
Vashti, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, Fuckfabble.
We see Vashti when it's first settled, and we see Vashti when Picard goes back, and we see the decay, and we see the apathy of the disgust of the Federation, and it tells us something. Whereas Metallus Prime is just kind of there, and it's got all these great, you know, it's got the set dressing is excellent. It's like, oh, it's freaking awful. But like, who are the people who live on Metallus Prime? Why is it a criminal thing if it appears to be part of the Federation, part of the Federation space? I call it the Treaty Zone, alleged midnight, you know what I mean? But it has no consequence apart from being set dressing.
And honestly, that's the thing too. I went to a panel at Los Angeles, or not Los Angeles, San Diego Comic-Con, where they had the set designer for Metallus Prime. And he was talking about all of his ideas for that set. And I'm like, that actually sounds interesting. And I would love to talk about that. Because like one of the things that he said is that this is never mentioned within the plot. But like they have a bunch of Borg stuff in the background that's like just like buildings are salvaged from Borg parts and things like that. And his idea was that, oh, there was a bunch of just Borg technology left over from like the Wolf 359 and a bunch of other things that people have been selling that we saw in season one of Picard, like people just like selling Borg stuff for a lot of money. And so, oh, you have this like society that has like reusing Borg tech. Because it's just prime technology to have. And I'm like, that's super fascinating. Never mentioned within the plot. And it's just sort of like Blade Runner criminal planet that just exists there for no real reason.
And then the fucking Daystrom. I hated Daystrom Station.
Oh, yeah. What, you mean Easter Egg Village?
Oh, yeah.
It just
and it's station observations.
It just didn't. It just kind of like was. I don't know whether I'm just being picky, but it's kind of like, well, it's there because they need a black site. And I don't like the idea of, ooh. And I just, there was everything about we have to go to a black site to rescue Data's corpse, which also has his brothers in it and sort of his uncle. And then they have to have a mind palace battle. Remember the mind palace battle, Olivia?
I just realized that Picard sort of follows the same weird tortured fate as Data in this, just sort of in this weird liminal space for no reason.
I actually can't remember why they went to Daystrom Station either, because they didn't go to find Data. They accidentally found Data because Data was just happened to be there.
It was
he's just around.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that
No, I was saying, going back to what you were saying about it being Planet Easter Egg, is I love a subtle Easter egg. I really do. I love it when there's a small little connection or a callback. They're so satisfying, especially if it's a clever and an earned one. But this show was so full of every minute. I hate the trope, but you know, it's the South Park episode of Member Berries. Remember Star Wars? Remember Chewbacca? You know? Remember Godfather?
What's so frustrating is that's also the episode where they go to the Fleet Museum with Geordi. So it's like they go to two locations in that episode, both of which are nostalgia Easter egg factories. One's a bunch of ships, and the one's just a bunch of like random knickknacks that they had from a bunch around Star Trek. And also that episode has, oh man, I could talk about LaForge for a minute too, but like the other one that frustrates me is they had that trailer before Picard season 3 came out, and it showed Moriarty at the end. I'm like, oh my God, they got Moriarty back. And I was thinking, as one naturally would, that this was going to be the Moriarty from TNG, where it was like he got trapped in that weird little cube, and they said, oh yeah, we'll free him and we'll figure out how to like give him a chance to be a sentient life form elsewhere and actually treat him with like dignity befitting a clearly sentient being. And then they just forgot about him. And so I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this season's villain was Moriarty, or at least he was like some level of sub boss in the season, where it's like he's not like a pull of like the Borg or the the changelings
Founders,
who are like main
changelings.
Villains of the show. The main villains of the show. He was like this weird thing off to the side, but could be a very interesting villain with a realistic grievance if you wanted to do a like Khan-esque like pull from a weird episode. And so I'm like, fascinating that he would have a real grievance. He'd be a great villain for the final season of and a great, like, oh, Moriarty versus Picard. Like, that would be a great season long arc of like him trying to get at him. Nope. He's just there to be like, oh, look, it's Moriarty. Do you remember that guy? This isn't even Moriarty.
He leads them through a little minefield. It's like kind of like a game, like an immersive experience.
Yeah, and he's just
he doesn't
there.
Even do that. He just kind of stands there and points a gun and goes, I keep hearing this song and there's a bird and bye.
You know, okay, we're going
to
do
which is also
it
a reference to Data's whistling from the series premiere of Next Generation. So it's like a nostalgia play on top of a nostalgia play.
Now, people say Lower Decks does too much. Jeez.
Here's the thing, right, which is the Pop Goes the Weasel motif being how Riker realizes that Data is running the system, Data's here, works for me because that scene, one of the only things in Picard Season 3 I like. Because that scene in the holodeck with Riker and Data is one of my favorite scenes in TNG, just because it's really neat, it's really clever, and it's a bit where Data's like, I am superior to you all the ways, and I give it all up just to be human. Which is just like, DC Fontana, genius, got it. Mm-hmm. And if that had been like the limit of the nostalgia it's willing to deliver, I'd have been really happy with it. But that's one thing I really like. So I am now going to throw this out to the rest of you, which is just give me one thing you liked.
I knew this was coming.
Oh, man.
I'll straight up say the performances of most of the TNG cast were spectacular. They've known each other now for coming on to 40-odd years. And it shows, you know, you really believe that when they, you know, Picard and Riker were kind of having a bit of a back and forth, it's back and forth between friends. When Worf shows up, you know, Michael Dorn has now been playing that character for 40 years and he inhabits that role. So the performances of all of the cast were absolutely spectacular. I can't fault a single one of them.
You go, Eleven.
Well, they did fix Worf. He became cool. He became less of a dick. It only took him, how old is he at this point?
Like, well, you say that, he still doesn't acknowledge his son at all.
Yeah, it's fine. You win some, you lose some. You win some, you lose some. Yeah. He's less of a pretentious douchebag, and he actually has the cool honor. It's like he got over it. He got over his teen issues at the ripe age of 80. I don't know how old he is.
Yeah, he's the thing I like. As I setting aside her death, I did actually like the scene with Ro and Picard where they like hash out their differences, because I did actually really like that. Like the point that scene was trying to get at is that, you know, Picard keeps talking about like, Ro, you betrayed Starfleet, you betrayed like what Starfleet values were. And she goes at him and is like, no, you are upset because I betrayed you. And you have so tied up your identity into what Starfleet is and the things Starfleet stands for that you like see them as one and the same. And that's how you can't like separate that Starfleet can do bad things. And I'm like, that's actually a really cool idea. I wish they had followed that through with like Picard actually like recognizing that Starfleet can perform like war crimes. Cause like that, sorry, this is just an aside. I'm getting into a rant, but like it goes into like the Dominion's like changeling stuff where it's like, oh, the changelings actually had war crimes done to them. And them having to realize that, and I'm like, oh, Picard having to like recognize that Starfleet can perform war crimes and not be this like idealistic organization all the time that he just like ties up all of his identity into and sort of gets lost in the pageantry of. But then it just ends with the Picard being like, yeah, well, that was pretty bad. Well, I guess we gotta kill the changelings now because they're too traumatized. Fuck that. But going back, like, the kernel of that arc there is seated in that scene with Ro that pulls like from their relationship in an actually way that seems to evolve it. So I did, despite that, I don't like where it ultimately goes. The seed of that like arc is there in that scene in a way I really like.
Yeah, I'm sort of fascinated by the half-assing of Dominion War consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Because the concept of the Federation doing terrible things to try and win the war is something that Deanne Stein interrogated and sort of was like, this is the price of freedom, but sometimes it's too high a price to pay. Khan doesn't even bother with is this too high a price? It's like, yeah, well, we're still gonna try and fucking kill you. It's
yep.
Because they want the aesthetic.
I was going to say, here's a damning indictment. Star Trek Insurrection did a better job of looking at the duality of, you know, the righteousness of Starfleet than Picard did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very true. I also like the disrespect to Deep Space Nine that they have to be like, look how cool the changelings are. We're going to make them redo the storyline that we already saw them do in Deep Space Nine. But it's like, okay, we learned they're a splinter group from the founders. So it's like, oh, you could do this whole thing where you like, go to the Great Link and actually be like, how does the Great Link feel about this break off of the changelings? So are they like, yeah, they actually have the right idea, like they should be getting back at the Federation, or like could they potentially reignite a new Dominion war? Like there's so much stuff there, but it just turns out to be like, no, they're actually just a sub boss for the next generation villain, and it they're just a sub boss for the Borg. And so it just has this like weird disrespect of like, yeah, the Deep Space Nine villains that were like the arc for that whole series, they and like a whole war for the Federation, they're just like subservient to like the Borg, because we all know the Borg are the coolest ones.
But it's also absolutely hog wild that, you know, we have the Dominion, who are insidious fascists who unironically like destroy a society from within because it's easier for them to do it that way. And they decided that the Borg are a more interesting villain for our current time.
Yep.
Well, I don't think it's a question of being more interesting. It's the TNG villain. And I think what's interesting to pick up on what Jesse was saying there is it's not just DS9, it's Voyager as well. I honestly mm-hmm. think if Seven hadn't been a big part of Picard in seasons one and two, and, you know, arguably the breakout character, really, the one thing from seasons one and two that universally everyone was like, this is great, we want more of Seven and Raffi. If that wasn't there in season one and two, I don't think you'd have had any references to Voyager outside of, you know, oh, look, there's Voyager at the Starfleet Museum. This was very much a show made by people who love the next generation and who kind of think that's the be all and end all. And the other stuff, oh, it was nice that these existed, they were cute, but they were just the little distractions, they were little side projects. Slight, they weren't
Tuvok's
really...
Tuvok's here. Look, do you like Tuvok?
Yeah, remember Tuvok? Remember Tuvok?
The other Vulcan.
It's fundamentally upsetting to me that they included Tuvok and not Elnor.
I know.
John, they did not have time for these new characters. Elnor was gone in the wind.
And also just like, you have the Borg here, and I'm like, as much as they were executed terribly in season two, I am fascinated. Like, I deeply, deeply want to write a story about what the hell like Borgrati is, like this consensual Borg. That's a fascinating idea that I'm like, I so desperately want to explore that concept, but it's like, nah, we're just gonna do Borg Queen. And I have, at some point we need to talk about the pervasive like underlying unexamined like sexism of this season. That's a whole separate thing. But see, also jumping,
I'm sorry, just my main, after a lot of humming and hawing about the concept of consensual Borg, I feel like my main thought is basically, it's like, well, the way I would do it would do just in a bit, there's not actually, oh wait, this is just like Rhodesia, isn't it? There's no consent going on here at all. You just kind of fucking tricked
yeah,
me.
Yeah,
I was
going
to say, I don't know how consensual that seemed. It seemed like they just ripped a very depressed person.
That's how I would explore. Again, there's so much, there's stuff there that you could explore with, I think, that whole idea of like, how consensual is it? How do people view that? Like, you have this whole ex-Borg society from season one, so like, do they have opinions on this new consensual Borg? Would there be like ex-Borg who are like, oh, I don't have an identity, I'm facing anti-Borg sentiment from the Federation, so like, I feel like I'm an ostracized person here, maybe I do want to go back to this Borg, if they're like actually saying like, oh, it's consensual, but then again, there's so many but then it could be fucked up, so like, there's so many things you could do with that like examines the ethics of that in some way, and like tying.
But they don't
want to
fucking
Borg
do
and,
that because
they don't.
Be
no,
boring.
They don't. No, no. And here's the other thing too. You were talking about Andy the like references to Voyager, and I just have to share this. So Terry Metalis did an interview where he talked about like some things they weren't able to do, and this is a storyline that I just need to share. It's like, this is his quote. There was an episode once the Titan was on the run and it needed to hide. And so we had this idea of Seven bringing them to sort of like Space Tortuga, like Space Dock for pirates where the Fenris Rangers were. and she gets help from an older Naomi Wildman, who had also followed in her footsteps as a Fenris Ranger and was a badass. But Seven realizes she sort of created a monster because Naomi had become harder than she was. And so it was a Seven-Naomi story. We broke the story when we had reached out to the actress who played Naomi, but it didn't feel like if you had 13 episodes, you were doing this for sure. But if you had 10, you're like, I need to get LeVar. It's time to get there. And so I just read that and I'm like, okay, so at least there was like an attempt to tie in Voyager stuff and also the Fenris Rangers, which I'm like, again, another idea that I would have liked to see explored more. But then also it becomes about like, yeah, we just need to like traumatize this relationship that Seven had with another child with Icheb and like make Naomi like instead of this girl who grows up to like be in Starfleet or no, we just need to make her harder and tougher and more traumatized. And I'm like, it's like does every woman's story, like, number one, they cut this one, so it's like, oh, we can't have a storyline between just two women. But then it's also like every woman's storyline has to be like some trauma happened between them at some point.
Listen, you got to pick one. You got to pick one: depressed or traumatized. I mean, They either got to be completely crushed, or you know, they're hardened to against the world. Yeah. That's feminism, Jesse.
Or they're a mom. They're a mom who complains about being a mom, so that's feminist. You know.
You see, if I was gonna bring Naomi back, I think Fenris Ranger would be the option I'd choose if you could find a way to do that properly, but it would be like, that's a consistent plot or a book.
Yeah.
Or the other option, if she's going to be just drop in for an episode and check Seven or something, I'd make her like a diplomat or something.
Yeah.
Something where it's like she got the life that Seven wanted for herself.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was going to bring her back, I'd bring her back in Prodigy, where there's writers who actually know and care about the characters, but you know, that's not
enough.
That's
all different. We love you, Aaron. We read your Twitter and we wonder if you're okay. Please tell us you're okay, Aaron. Please.
This is an Aaron Solidarity podcast.
Yeah.
But
I was just going to say, one of the things that has kind of really, knocked me a little bit, is some of the interviews that we've had post the reception of Picard have very much been the case of where there have been takes, which I haven't necessarily agreed with. What happened to Roe? What happened to Shelby? What happened to Elnor and stuff like this? There's been this continuous sense of, oh, don't know why, they're not dead. They're not dead. Oh, we were going to have a shot where they were, you know, shown in the brig, but they were fine. And it just feels like if you're not willing to commit to the choices that you make in the show, then how valid are they from a storytelling perspective? And I wanted to kind of circle this back to something you were saying earlier about letting things end. It's the difference between content and stories. Contents can never end because content has to continue, has to keep on going. Mm-hmm. Whereas stories need to have an ending. And I also think that's part of a problem we've had here with Picard season 3 is it is explicitly being set up as a backdoor pilot to a legacy show. I mean, this entire last year have been nothing but hashtag Star Trek legacy and so on and so forth. There's a desire to continue this story. And look, that's fine. A lot of people love this and I don't want to take anything away from that. But it was at the expense of this show and this story because they had to be in a certain place for whatever that spin-off show is going to be. You know, that's how we get the Enterprise G. Do not get me started on the Enterprise G, John. Do not get me started. But it gets to this.
We'll be back.
We'll circle
remind
back
me,
around.
Remind me to tell you something off mic because I can't say it, but I have something to say about the Enterprise G that I'll say off mic.
Oh, I might know this, but we'll compare spicy notes there. But my point is, it's this sense of the Roe thing. I hated what they did to Roe. I hated what they did to Shelby. I hated the suggestion that Elnor was killed. But if those are story beats you're going to do to motivate the characters, if those are things you want to do to, commit to them. It's like, yeah, Roe's dead. Okay, it sucks, but that's just how life happens and we go forward. But when you say that, it means no death has any meaning. I mean, straight away after Shaw was killed, within a day, well, certainly after the last episode, it's like, oh, don't worry, I'm sure Shaw will be back in the Legacy series. Q's back
don't
now, you know?
Fucking kill him. This is the point.
Exactly.
Cowards.
They truly didn't know that he was going to be popular, I assume, is the issue there.
But how could you not know? How do you not look at Todd Stashwick's genuinely standout performance in that show and say, people won't be mad when we kill him?
It's too late. Filming started, John.
This is also my counterpoint to why I also fundamentally don't think fans can be trusted. And for the listeners at home, I have pulled my pipe out to use it as a prop.
Yeah, guys, I think John's smoking opium. I'm not sure.
I would be this angry.
Chase that dragon, John. Chase that dragon. You'll get there.
It's all very simple, which is fans are not to be trusted. Commit to killing people. don't bring her back. When a fan's like, oh, I wish you didn't kill her, but he was such a great character. No, the fact that they're upset he's dead means you've done it right. You've won.
Yeah, exactly.
If people are mad, somebody died, it's good. No, you know, what character death in the last like 40 years, last 40 years of like pop culture do people still mad about?
Battlestar Galactica, still to this day, haunts me.
Olivia hasn't got that far. Olivia hasn't got
that
far.
No, it's okay.
Oh, okay. Also, you got the Red Wedding in
Red Wedding.
Thrones.
Yeah. That. Padme. I hate
she
to talk
lost
about...
the will to live, John. She lost the will to live.
I hate to talk about the Scottish woman. But people are still mad, who still like it. People are still mad about Dumbledore dying. Because she doesn't commit it. Because you commit to it. I mean,
yeah,
he also committed to being a horrible bigot, obviously, but that's commitment.
Yeah. She's all in. Yeah.
Hold on. Counterpoint. What about the 1,500 times Spock dies? Now I get the tradition.
Again, it's
death means nothing.
But here's the point. They did kill Spock.
And he came back, bitch.
Spock dies in Star Trek Beyond, and it starts an existential crisis for Kelvin Spock, and that's really important for the plot.
And he also, I was going to say, with Spock, it was very much the exception that proves the rule, in the sense of, at the end of Star Trek 2, he is dead. They do leave a seed, but they didn't go into Star Trek 2 knowing that in the next film they were going to bring him back. For all intents and purposes, Leonard Nimoy was done with that character, and it was only later on that they wrote a way to bring him back. I'm much more okay with that than you kill a character, and then in the back of your mind, your sense is, but no, it's fine. You know, we can just bring it back.
But
didn't see a body. We didn't see a flat line. It's fine.
But also, in Star Trek's Three and Four, brings Spock back. But Kirk loses everything he's worked for. He loses
also,
his
David
ship.
Doesn't come back.
And he loses it. He loses his ship. He loses his career. He loses his son.
It's the three
things that matter to him to get Spock back. It's earned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will also say, too, like, it goes to what you were saying, Andy. Like, all of this stuff is just... The problem with this, and the problem that I'm seeing more and more with so many franchises, but especially with like Star Trek and Picard season 3, I think being the biggest example of it, which is why I don't want a legacy to tie it back a Star Trek legacy show, at least from like if it builds off of this, which is that it's all content now. It's not science fiction that is actually saying something about today, trying to make a commentary about today. It's about, I love Star Trek. Let's talk about like Star Trek stuff. And that's what Picard season 3 really is just doing the member berries over and over and over again, instead of actually trying to say something meaningful with Star Trek. And I don't think all Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Strange New Worlds, I have criticisms of the way those shows handle it, but at least those shows are like trying to say something. Whereas Picard season 3 really doesn't seem like it has anything it wants to say, because it doesn't commit to anything at all.
See, that's the thing. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I watched all of I watched the Strange New World season 2 background content. People know how I feel about Strange New World season 2. Mm-hmm. But it's Henry.
Very quick question. When are you going to do a musical episode of I Quit Star Trek?
Yes. Immediately, yes.
Fuck.
Yeah, immediately, yes.
We're doing, Olivia,
violet sky. I could be purple. I could be purple. I could be anything you like.
We're doing Olivia, you're singing Triplet Power Ballad. That's my own condition. But anyway, I didn't like Lost Station 2, but Henry Alonso Myers and Kiefer Goldsman are quite explicit about that they were trying to do something. You know, Ad Astra Perispera has a lot of issues, but they are fun. The showrunners are abundantly clear that they were trying to do something when they wrote that episode. And my favorite episode of season 6 is the one with Uhura and the refinery.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do something. They're trying to talk about loss and overcoming loss and fear and what it means. And they're trying to do that with. I've not seen a Picard season 3 interview where the writers have gone, we're trying to do this. They've just gone, oh, it's so great to have X back or do X again. It's like, what were you trying to do? Star Trek is, sorry, if you go back to 64 and you read Star Trek is, Gene Roddenberry is very abundantly like, I'm doing this because I want to tell stories with a point. And that what makes me different from Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
Beedie, 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 beedie.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. Like, I look at Picard season three and I'm like, what is this season trying to say? And I guess like there are things that I could point to be like, I guess there's a kernel of an idea there. So like the thing I was talking about of Starfleet as an institution, like, could be questioned, and that's why we have the Dominion sort of infiltrating it, and then Picard having to wrestle with, like, maybe this institution that I've loved can do war crimes, as we see, like, with the villain, her having been the victim of, like, Vadic, her getting being the victim of, like, potentially Section 31 war crimes. But then that's undercut when you have Picard just going, well, let's just murder her now. Gotta go deal with the Borg to protect the Federation and protect the Federation president, and it's Frontier Day, so we gotta celebrate Starfleet. And so it's like that theme is completely undercut by the last two episodes. You have ideas of like legacy and passing on to the next generation, which like again feels like a somewhat fitting theme. Like you have Picard passing it on to his son and things like that, but it really ends up becoming more just like, hey, he is me again. It's just like, it's not the legacy moves beyond you. It is, look at these people who are just us pressed into the future again. And like, it reminds me of with you coming up with next generation, like Gene Roddenberry coming up with Next Generation. Again, a lot of problems in that mindset, but like, at least when I look at Next Generation, it's like they made an explicit point to be like, we're not going to have like a grandchild of Kirk beyond the bridge or something like that.
It's much worse than that as well, though, because one of the key conceits of this is the Borg mind virus infects everyone under 25.
We're going to get into it. What is up with the Gen Z slander? Who does the best Alex Jones?
Who does the best Alex Jones?
The globalist Borg are coming to get you, really. Their nano probes are in all of our foods. You gotta buy my anti-Borg milk. That'll get rid of the
you know it's Barclay in this timeline. At this point, it's Barclay. Alex Jones in the 25th century is Barclay. It's Barclay there who's going, I told you all the transporters were going to turn you all insane and
turn you all gay.
The transporter mind virus.
Turn you all gay, I mean Borg. And that's the
thing. The transporters are going like kids Borg.
Can I make, I know I've had so many rants and I promise I will stop because I want to let other
Jesse,
people
I didn't invite I just, you I here to be quiet.
Fair enough. I need to rant about the woke mind virus thing, especially as it relates to queerness so badly.
Wait, before you stop.
Yes.
I'll take a shot.
I'm going to do a little rant and try and make this as quick as possible, as best I can. But like, the ex-Borg in Star Trek Picard season one are, again, they aren't used very well, but they are so good at like taking the fascism metaphor that the Borg have kind of become, because the Borg, once you introduce the Borg Queen, like you could talk about the Borg of Next Generation being like a representation of like neoliberalism or fear of collectivism.
Lovecraftian horror.
Like there's a lot of things that you put onto the Borg depending on your interpretation of it. But once you introduce the Borg Queen in First Contact, it really becomes like this authoritarian fascism metaphor of like this authoritarian who presses everybody into being just like them and trying to make everyone the same. That's kind of what the Borg are once you introduce her. And when you bring in the XB in season one, I actually really love the XBs so much because, and a shout out to Hi, because Hi is the best, our mutual friend Hi, who writes so much beautifully about the Borg and the XBs. But like, they become this very obvious queer metaphor of not just like queer as like a sexual minority, though by having Hugh being a gay man, the actor Jonathan Delacroix, like it kind of ties into that. But like these people who are trying to reclaim their identity and personhood outside of this fascist thing that has tried to push them all down and be the same. But then them also, when they go and try and find refuge in other societies or other places, are still also exiled from that for being seen as like, oh, they're ex-Borg. They're part of like this group that is oppressed. So like they face stigma in so many different ways. So it creates this beautiful, like interesting, like queer found family, queer metaphor where it's like these people from different groups and societies who have all been harmed are still all queer together in this collective of like this collective, probably the wrong word for use for them at this point, but like a queer like society that you create with them. And then you go to Picard season three, and it literally with through Harrigan, Ed Spiller, Picard Jr.'s character, they like literally say he was born Borg. So they continue the gay metaphor of like, oh, Picard's semen is Borg semen, and you have him being born part Borg, and he am literally saying at one point near the end of like, I felt like this call to a collective, and like he literally connects like this, like they use the language of being gay to talk about him being gay, but then they connect it to like his gayness is his call towards the Borg. So his gayness then becomes coded in like his gayness is what pulls him to fascism. And that ties into the whole idea of like, oh, the gays are the real fascists, you see, that you get from like someone like J.K. Rowling or all those folks. And then you have the Borg creating a literal woke mind virus in the kids. And then they have when they act, and this is the one that pissed me off the most, because it just reads as like cis dude not even thinking about it. But it's like all the youths are turned into mini Borg by a woke mind virus by the Borg that they have explicitly coded as gay, which is now tied into fascism. So gay is fascism. And then they have a non-binary character on the Bridge of the Titan as one of the side characters. And that is the one when the Borg takes over the youth. That's the character that sits in the Titan chair, like as the captain seat. So you have the non-binary character who is controlled by the woke mind virus of fascism being the one in charge of the youths. And so it's like, it's just coding non-binariness and transness as like this queer, like this fascistic queer metaphor, and they need to like cure them of their woke mind virus. And it again, like, I don't necessarily sit here and be like, oh, this was intentional. They intentionally tried to do this. I imagine it was like, oh, we can use the language of gayness for the Borg. It'll be kind of cool, without thinking through what that means for the interpretation of it. And it's just awful.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating how you can have all these art. There's a lot of discourse around whether intentional, but it's all very simple, which is that they just didn't think it through, did they? Like, mm-hmm. I know you said there's a bit of it that they were just trying to skip through this, but they just.
No, thank you, Jesse, for vindicating my utter depression, Picard, because that's brought me to new lows. New lows!
Yeah. it's just not thinking through it, because they don't have like queer or trans people like really speaking up about that. And like, I know there was some like potentially some queer writers on the show or whatever, but it's just, you've really got to think through how these all things interconnect within a franchise like this. And it just frustrates me that they really don't. And as a result, they have superficial like representation of like, hey, look, the non-binary person's there. But like, how are you using that non-binary character is important. And also like, oh, Seven and Raffi can't beat. We have to break them up again between seasons, because ultimately, like, there was like an interview with Terry Metalis where he said, we needed to break up Seven and Raffi because we knew where they were going to end up on the bridge together, and I didn't want to have like first officer and captain being in a relationship together. And I'm like, number one, if that's the story you want to tell, that's actually fine. I understand, like, there are power dynamics, and you could talk about that and what that would mean. But, like, have that be an explicit part of the relationship instead of just, like, them just, like, we broke up off screen, we'll make a joke about it and never mention it again. Like, have that be a part of the relationship. But then also, so there's that. But then there's the double standard of, like, your whole season is built upon the premise that Beverly and Picard had a secret ongoing relationship for the entirety of the Next Generation that, like, was hinted at in the show.
Riker and Troy were literally married on the Titan. I mean, they had a kid.
Yeah, so it's like there's a double standard.
Respectfully, is there a single Terry Metalis interview that wasn't just damage control for the season?
Probably the one... No.
Well, you say damage control. This is the thing, though. This season was just... Trek Twitter as a large absolutely loved it. And I think a lot of it just comes down to the fact
not
it was the pure
members.
Guys, Trek Twitter is the foundation of this podcast. But guys, please go read a book.
Yeah.
I love you all very dearly. You're all great friends. I love chatting to you constantly. But like...
Turn on him.
Go read,
get
go
him,
read,
guys.
Go read The Three Musketeers. It's fucking banging. And I'm going to do that, like, you know, now. I could tell you that the Cardinal's Musketeers will beat our heroes, but they're not. And I'm going to tell you because our heroes are great. It's great. Go read The Three Musketeers. This was not a good story.
I mean, I've got a question. So does anyone know anyone whose only interaction with Star Trek was Picard season 3? I mean...
Dear God.
Fuck
because I would never do that to my friends.
But my point is, I don't think if this was your only exposure to Star Trek, I mean, like, if you go and watch Strange New Worlds, Lower Decks, Discovery, any of the other new Treks, there's a lot there for people just kind of joining the Star Trek fandom for the first time, you know, is a good in. Whereas this, I think it's so deep in the lore of the Next Generation that you're really not going to pick up on half of it if you're not familiar with everything which kind of came before, at least to a certain level. It went out of its way to kind of discredit seasons one and two. So you don't need to watch any of Picard to watch this.
Absolutely.
You're fine. But you need to know the Next Generation to get it. And going back to a point you said earlier about, you know, fans kind of writing the show, I keep looking over at Andor, Tony Gilroy's done. And the wonderful thing there is he's explicitly said he just was not a fan of Star Wars before he did that. He was very much... Mm-hmm. There was a story, there was an idea he wanted to explore, and he wanted to tell that in the world of Star Wars. And the thing with that is, you can take Cassian and Andor out of that and stick anyone else into that role, and that show will still work absolutely perfectly. It is not reliant upon the connections and, you know, the member berries, for lack of a better word, to what's gone before. Whereas with Picard...
Andor could be set in upstate New York in 1781.
I mean, I'd ask a lot of questions about the lasers and the droids, but other than that, absolutely, yeah, you know, I definitely
you
don't
get my point.
I think like the best way to use a franchise, and I think Deep Space Nine kind of did this, where it's have a story that you want to tell, that you want to say, and if you're setting it in an IP, like, just tell the story that you want to tell, and then have someone who's there who can be like, while you're telling the story and you're like, oh, we need like a planet that has like that it's colonized or something and whatever. It's like, oh, you can actually use this idea instead of it being
York.
Like, how do
you need a York there?
Yeah, exactly. Where it's just like, it's like, tell the story you want to tell first and then bring in what stuff from the franchise fits that story, rather than the impetus being like, I want to use the Borg. How do I get a story that uses the Borg? It's like, tell the story you want to use first, and maybe the Borg fit best for that, rather than I want to use the Borg. What's the story I can do to use the Borg? Because then that just becomes about like that you're just finding a way to do what the thing was already. You're just trying to justify doing the thing that they were already used for, rather than telling something that you feel an earnest desire to tell, and using the tools that are then available to you to do that.
But also, it comes back to this. Well, I've had a discussion with Andy. I think I might have had a discussion with you, Jesse. I would have had a discussion with Olivia, but I wouldn't want to upset her by talking about it.
Thank you.
But it comes back to this problem of Trek at all. Actually, all franchise content now just shipper theseusing themselves, in the sense that, to use an example very relevant, like to use, for example, that Battle of the Mitara Nebula, right? They want a starship combat action. And they go back to Mitara Nebula, because it's like, that's a big starship battle everyone likes. Whereas when Robert Meyer did Mitara Nebula, he didn't go back to Balance of Terror. He went and read some Hornblower and some Patrick O'Brien, and thought about and adapted that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, everything feels like they're trying to adapt Star Trek.
I got to ask a question.
Does
anyone here think that the people who were involved in writing this Star Trek Picard series would have been able to write Star Trek, an episode of Star Trek, if TNG didn't exist?
No.
I don't want to be that mean, because I feel like given, it could be that if you give these writers, because I mean, I look at Terry Metalis and I look at something like, I mean, I still have problems with it, but his version of 12 Monkeys, which feels like he's much less precious about 12 Monkeys. And so like, I have issues with that show, but at least there's like, he's less precious about referencing 12 Monkeys in that show. And because it's only like a 2-hour movie and a short, like the original Legit short, like he has to extrapolate so much more to make a TV series out of it. So like, there's, I can tell he has, like, I'm not saying Terry Metalis is a bad writer. I'm just saying when he showed up to the assignment for Star Trek, he became a fan fiction writer. And I think that's a lot of the problem with a lot of writers coming into this stuff. So it's like, they have a willingness to pull from other things when it's not Star Trek. But when it's like part of a franchise, there's this willingness to just want to pull from the franchise. And it's something I talked about in my Star Wars. I did a video on Star Wars Monomyth. That's six hours long. You should watch, because this everything we're discussing is what this is about. Is about how Star Wars, like, franchises start off with these impetuses to want to tell, like, a story. But then as they go along and continue along, they just, the semiotics of, like, the signs that they are pointing to, of, like, this was meant to be a sort of, like, pointing at fascism and the Nazis. But then it becomes, now we're just pointing back at Star Wars, and it's just referencing themselves and just pulling from themselves, and the meaning just gets diluted and diluted until it ultimately means nothing. And that's what capitalism, if I'm going to rant about capitalism here, that's what capitalism does. It just makes these things products. And to make things products, they have to just be able to make you feel an emotion without it having any actual depth. And that's also how fascism works, too. That's why capitalism and fascism work in tandem to a degree, where it's like fascism wants you to just see power, see aesthetics, see just like how cool something looks, and not feel any pull towards something deeper within it. And that's why I think a lot of our society today just like is pulling towards that, because people aren't thinking deeply about anything with a lot of like the art that was originally so radical in a lot of what it was saying. I'm not saying it's just about art, but it's an emblematic of the larger problem. And also the style of storytelling that we tell, which is the monomyth storytelling that is exemplified literally by the title Picard, which is like we have a single character who like Star Trek is supposed to be about, this egalitarian society where we have so many different people working together to create something that like is trying to enable everybody to be their best self. And instead it becomes, look how cool this one hero character is, like Picard or our captain character, which is the problem of all of Star Trek. But like it is exemplified here by having a show named Picard, where it's like it's about this character who is our hero character who we love, instead of a story about people working together to build each other up. And we just consistently try to make these monomythical hero style journeys where it's like we forget all the people that helped this guy get to where he is. It is just about Picard, and we have like his, and everyone sort of orbits around him, and we have, it all pulls into like him being this centrist story. And so it's all these things work together, and that's what my Star Wars video is about, if you're curious.
And for the betting, I mean, his illusions. Jesse did say capitalism 5 times.
I did. Yeah. It's almost as if I'm anti-capitalist. It's fun.
I was gonna say, I think there's a lot of allusions there between the depiction of Jean-Luc Picard and also with Luke Skywalker in mm-hmm. Star Wars. And this is one of the reasons why I love The Last Jedi so much, is it evolves and moves the character forward. That, you know, a lot of people have loved like the Star Wars expanded universe and the books and all this, but the problem with tie-in literature as a general rule is the characters are stationary from when you last see them on screen. In the entirety of the Star Wars EU, no one evolved or changed in any real sense from who they were from dancing on the Ewok village at the end of Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to The Last Jedi and you see there's a character there who has gone through 30, 40 years of life and trauma and has grown and changed. And it felt to me like, okay, I want to know what's led to this point, not that's not the character who I expected to be. And that's kind of what was interesting in Picard season one. Picard in season one was not the captain that we had last seen in Nemesis on the Bridge of the Enterprise. And that was fascinating. But over the course of the 3 seasons, and especially season three, I mean, it literally ends with him sitting back in the center chair of the Enterprise, NCC-1701-D, right back where he was, you know, so many years mm-hmm. ago. But there's been no mm-hmm. development or evolution of that character. And I dare say if someone was to watch just Encounter at Farpoint and then watch the Next Generation episode of Picard, you know, you'd be like, okay, so this is like a week later, is it? You know, a week and a half?
The biggest thing you'd be mad about is that Tasha's gone.
Basically, yeah.
That would be the only yeah. thing that would confuse you. Tasha and possibly the existence of... But that also comes back to this content point, which is... Not to go all Joseph Campbell on you.
You're going to, though.
I'm going to anyway, because you can't get away from that, Nancy. But you can't, if you have an arc, you have to have an ending. Like, you can't just arc up into the air like a fucking space missile.
Has anyone told TV producers this?
TV producers know this. They just know that if they tell it to the Hollywood execs who've only ever watched a Marvel film, they'll get sacked.
I've just had a terrible revelation. This is very much this is the storytelling of stocks, isn't it? They're trying to get their bit out on the top of the curve and just get out before the whole thing collapses.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
Welcome to Western-style storytelling.
This wasn't a TV show. It was a cathartic experience for the people involved, John. They don't want it to end.
Let's not use any metaphors with it. It was a masturbatory aid for 45-year-old studio executives.
They needed to heal.
If that's a word for masturbation you want to use, Olivia, we can use it.
It's something that I want to do. Like, I'm sorry, this is my sort of thing. I'll keep this quick, but like, I'm working on a pitch for a TV show, and I have like a whole arc plan for the series. And like, the way I want the show to end is like a character near the final end of the season, like, is talking to a character who's not from, because it's a whole series about it's an anti-capitalist show or whatever. But then a character being like, "How do we finish this? Like, how do we stop this thing?" It's like someone saying, "Oh, well, you need to like break this story, this loop of like you become the hero, you become the person on top. Like, it's not about getting revenge." It's about trying to move and create something different and tell a different story and them talking through.
Yeah, you're not allowed to kill the Fire Lord. We've been
exactly. And it's just like, tell a different story. And most stories should end is they live. Every single story should just end with a screen that says they lived a life and then they died and something new happened. And I just want to like, and I want to just tell the end of the show ends, and then just have a screen come up after it, like that just says literally that it's like, all the characters lived a life and then they died and something new happened. It's like,
the world continued to turn and all was well.
Yes, exactly. As opposed to they kept doing the same thing that they were going to do.
Patrick Picard season 3 tries to be the same galaxy we saw in TNG. You know, not even Nemesis, TNG. You know how we know they're trying this so hard? What the fuck are the Klingons doing?
Yeah.
The Bats just have Romulan Star Empire swap for Romulan Free State. There's no sense that a Romulan Empire has collapsed. There's no sense that the Klingons have changed at all. You know, Star Trek Online immediately assumes that the moment the Romulans collapse, the Klingons just back out of the whole Kitimer agreement because there's no need for it, and they just go straight back on the warpath because that's exactly what would happen. And Picard just isn't fundamentally interested in the idea that the galaxy has changed in 25 years because, like a lot of people, like a lot of content, is obsessed with the idea that the world hasn't changed in 25 years. When it has. I'm sorry, guys. The Twin Towers blew up. I didn't see it. You all did.
John, where were you 25 years ago? Just say real quick.
I was having a wonderful nap time. And I know this very well. But that's just a lack of utter historicity to characters, to the world. You know how they made Space Dock? They updated Space Dock? They put 4 more tiny Space Docks around it.
And then we just move the other space dock to another system because which that's what you can do now. Yeah.
I was going to say, but
that goes back to what we were saying before. You know, season 1 of Picard, for all its faults, it was a different galaxy. You know, that moment when Picard is given the interview and, you know, they're asking, why did you leave Starfleet? Because it wasn't Starfleet anymore. You cannot really connect Picard as he was in TNG to that person. A lot of life has happened there. That's interesting. I wanted to see what was happening.
Yeah.
You're seeing the fallout of the collapse of the Romulan Star Empire. The entire geopolitical shape of the galaxy has completely changed.
The Federation's first enemy fell apart at the seams and the Federation did nothing. It was Praetor Shinzon, tear down this wall, and we saw none of it.
Yeah. But instead, what they decided to do is they get to the end of it and they say, and then a copy place fleet shows up. There's a tentacle monster. Picard is now a robot and status quo.
He should have fucking died. They should have blown
him up. He should have died. And also, my headcanon is seasons 2 and 3 of Picard, immediately the last synapse is firing off as his brain slowly implodes from the Iwamonic syndrome.
Honestly,
hold on. This fixes everything.
Yeah, that does fix everything, doesn't it? I deal with my shit with my dad. Like figure that out in my brain. I get to meet my friends.
I got that son I always wanted. Yeah. I just remembered the great, the earnest, I must send him an email on something, Manu Sider, also Trekonomics and the most deadpan Frenchman in the world. His eternal take is that Picard should have just been Jean-Luc Picard arguing with a local wine board about land appropriation. And then being like, Jean-Luc, I'm sorry. It's not your turn to use that part of the land plots. You're going to have to give it to George over there who wants to grow fucking zucchini. And it's like, no, but we're growing wine. The crop isn't ready yet. It's like, but it's this turn. You know, he's been on the list for 30 years. That would have
been... Did I ever tell you, Mike? Did I ever tell you my pitch for what Picard should have been, like before it all started? I mean, I had two. So my serious one was, you know, the one everyone was saying, we wanted a West Wing in space. But the good one was, it was actually Fawlty Towers in space, where Picard is running a guest house, and then God. Q keeps showing up. And it was just basically a entire 24th century spin on Fawlty Towers, with Picard just trying to, you know?
I love that. Yeah. better than, we didn't even mention the John DeLancey popping in at the end for the after credit sequence, and he's not really.
No, we did briefly mention it, because it goes back to that whole not owning your choices.
John
okay, you killed Q.
John DeLancey popped into that room the same way I nearly knocked him over.
John, what did you do to John DeLancey?
I didn't
John
hurt
attacked
it.
John
I
DeLancey
just frightened John, I just frightened John DeLancey, and I reacted like I hadn't, and it seemed to freak out a lot of people.
Oh, John, having now like actually worked with him in a professional capacity, he is actually the sweetest. Like, legitimately, very intense man. Like, and not in like a mean way. It's just like when he showed up on set for my film, sign up for Nebula, the streaming service, to get my film. Everybody, yay! I'll hawk my own wares. But John DeLancey's in the movie, and he showed up on set, and he was. It was a very queer set. We had buttons with pronouns for everybody. He'd never misgendered anybody. He showed up being like, I want to work. Like, let's talk about the script. Like, let's go over these lines. Like, it was very intense, but it was an intensity that's like, I care about doing this really well. Like, he was just doing, like, he could have just showed up and been like, all right, let's get this done. I'm here for the day. Let's spill my scene. He's like, no, it's like, I want to do a really good job. Let's just go. Let's move. And he was amazing. And then he's just been like, we've been doing voiceover and stuff with him, and he's just been like, yeah, let's do it, let's sign up, well, I'll show up when you want me. So like, he's like, John DeLancey is like the sweetest man.
Oh, look, for all the problems with Picard season two, DeLancey was certainly not one of them, because you know, every scene he's in, I'm there for John DeLancey.
No, he was really good in season two. He sold the idea that he kind
he was
of
was there in season three.
he was definitely there.
But it's,
in
I mean,
three.
Even that comes back to this point, which is like the most powerful emotional beat in Picard season two is the idea that Q is dying, and he just wants to say goodbye to the only person who's ever mattered to him.
Yeah, that scene at the it's like, for all the faults of season two, like that scene at the end where he does say goodbye to Picard, like I was like, oh. My two little gay boys are having a moment. They're figuring it out, and like also just like him trying to like use his last few moments to be like, Picard, like, deal with your shit. Like, I want to give you this catharsis at the end of your life and like give you something meaningful in a really fucked up way that nearly destroys the entire galaxy as we know it, because that's Q.
That's very on brand,
yeah. Yeah. But it's like, I want to give you some emotional catharsis here before I die, because it matters to me. It's like, that feels like an interesting evolution of his character, an interesting end to his character. And again, it's like, it wasn't executed well, which is always the problem you will say with Star Trek Picard scenes one and two, is like, good ideas executed fair to poorly. And then you have Picard season three, which I think is like an absolutely atrocious idea executed very well.
Yeah, it's like getting on the central line.
Yeah.
But if you get to your destination, it was fantastic. But fuck me, was it horrible?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. It's the difference. I think it's the it's the Star Wars prequel sequel problem, where it's like, the prequels, great ideas, conceptually fantastic, executed pretty poorly overall. But then the sequels, terrible idea, terrible concepts outside of like you arguably The Last Jedi, but executed really wonderfully. Like, beautifully done. Yeah.
I also think, just on a wider point, Picard, the series as a whole, really made a rod for its own back from the very beginning, when it laid out that it had these rules. And Picard, you know, Patrick Stewart went on stage and he said, you know, the rest of the TNG cast will not be appearing outside of maybe one or two cameos. And I will at no point be appearing in a Starfleet uniform. And, you know, he was going really far out of his way to say, this is going to be a different show to TNG. Fair enough. You know, he'd done however many years of doing that, and he wanted to do something different. But when the Penthe dropped, it was at that point, I think, the penny dropped for everyone else. Is the reason we wanted to revisit and see Picard is because we'd grown up loving this family, these people, you know, this family we'd all grown up with. And, you know, they've become very close behind the scenes. You know, you just have to go and see any appearance, whether at a con, they love each other very clearly. And so that was kind of like what everyone wanted to see. But then by the time you get to that, you've had those first two seasons, and it's almost like you have to, well, you do have to pretend those don't exist, and then you have to convolutedly have this story, which is just not satisfying, and it's just, as I was saying before, it's just a whole lot of member berries. It definitely feels like, as I said earlier, if this was the only Star Trek we'd had since 2005, like there'd been none of Discovery, none of Strange New Worlds, none of anything else, I'd have probably been all over it. Just from, you know, anyone walking through the desert and you find a glass of water. God, this is the best glass of water I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But in the weight of everything else which has come along more recently, and just how storytelling and shows have evolved, and Star Trek has evolved and changed, it just became really, really apparent that this wasn't what we were looking for. And I put a tweet out a while ago where a lot of people are clamoring for, you know, Star Trek Legacy is the show they want. And look, mm-hmm. I am all here for a show fronted by Seven of Nine with Raffi as first officer on a ship, ideally not called the Enterprise G, but whatever.
But not we'll that fucking that. One.
But mm-hmm. I'm all here for that. But the show I want is a show going forward and exploring strange new worlds, you know, pushing forward the galaxy. The very definition of a name Legacy, you kind of, you're already sticking an anchor around your neck, but it's going to be the show of, oh, look, and here's so-and-so who showed up in episode 6 of Deep Space Nine. I think the show people want, that is the big callback, the love letter to that era, it's called Lower Decks. It's already there. And I got to tell you, it's pretty perfect, you know?
Why, and even Lower Decks, you know, it is the callback show. And that's the thing. It's like, I love Lower Decks. It's my favorite current rerunning Star Trek show. I love it to death. But I love it as like awareness of what it is like, mm-hmm. it is a celebration of Star Trek past. And it's like, it should, the callback show should be confined to that. And even Lower Decks takes its moments to make a stamp on Star Trek that is something new. Like, while it is pulling from a previously established alien race, the Orions, like, all the stuff they've done with Orion culture and with Tendi as a character, I think is actually really wonderful. Like, there's doing something new. Hell, it's ridiculous, but, like, the stuff like the koala, the great koala.
The koala is hilarious. The Ferengi War Memorial. Did you see Nathan Goldberg's Actually, the Ferengi were the financial powerhouse that won the Dominion War article. I will send this to you. It's a banger.
That's
it's
amazing.
Or the packlets as well, just expanding them.
Yeah.
Like, it's doing, it's like, it is pulling from these old things. And here's the other thing, too. If you want a good, what Star Trek Picard Season 3 should have been, play the game Star Trek Resurgence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Yeah. Star Trek Resurgence is incredible.
Resurgence is, because it does the same thing. It's like, it's set in like a TNG era ship. Like, they have like the post the Dominion War era uniforms. It's a very Starfleet-esque ship. And it is like, I don't want to spoil too much for those who haven't played it, but it is pulling from a TNG episode quite directly. A wild one to pull from, but it pulls from a TNG episode and actually takes those themes in that episode and does something very new with them. And very similar to like the Changeling plot in Star Trek Picard Season 3, but it's doing it in a new way with different things to say about it. It's different ways to talk about racial purity in like radicalized groups within like an alt-right groups within these racial purity ideologies. Like, that game does that, and it also is a nostalgia play by pulling something from TNG. It even has Spock and Riker in it, but at least it's like doing something with like things that we aren't usually focused on and trying to like use those tools in a new way. And it's like, I would not necessarily want a whole Star Trek Resurgence show necessarily, but like,
I take a miniseries.
Yeah, if you take,
I take a 10-part miniseries.
Yeah, if you took, well, I'm just, what I'm saying is, if you had taken Resurgence and just made that, like, swapped out the characters of Resurgence with like the TNG Picard cast and made that Season 3 of Picard, perfect. I would have been like, that should have been what Picard Season 3 would have been, and I would have been like, this was a great, like, still nostalgia-y, but feels like it's trying to do something new and feels like a satisfying conclusion to them. Like, Resurgence is everything that I think Star Trek Picard should have been, Season 3 specifically.
Yeah, oh God, it's just, it's fascinating that Resurgence and Picard were developed at similar times. Resurgence is just fundamentally a better piece of storytelling. It's fundamentally more interested in thinking about minority politics, about class politics, about imperialism, racial superiority, the burden of what command means.
The fact that that game has a section, like, the thing I was like, oh, I'm in for this game. For the two things that it does in that game is, like, the opening sequence, you are playing as two different characters, one on the Lower Decks, one who is the number one who sometimes takes the captain's role when the captain's not there. And there's a section where you as the captain are making choices about like how to protect the ship. And then it cuts to your lower deck characters who are outside on the ship doing repairs, and they get, and like the choices that you make as the captain affect like the dangers that you have to deal with as the lower deck crew, and actually can lead to you having a scar for the whole game because you are like hurt by the choices that you made as the captain. And like, that's actually talking about like class differences within Starfleet. And then there's also the whole like the whole plot of like they go to this planet, and the whole planet is like there is a two races. One is the elite class, one is the workers that are mining for the elite class, and the workers have seized the means of production of the mines, and now you need to negotiate that. And I'm like, I am here for what this is trying to do.
Yeah, and it also, but it also talks about how those causes get corrupted by arrogance.
Yep. I didn't want to spoil too much.
But it's sophisticated.
Yeah.
In a way that Picard isn't, because Picard's too busy trying to be the Star Trek you watched or remember watching. Here's the point. How many times... TNG is a show famous for people sitting around tables talking about nonsense. Picard season 3 only does that once. And it's this big, oh, we're back around a table talking nonsense moment. I swear to God, if I could do anything in the world, I would just take the IP for a Le Carre novel and adapt it in Star Trek, because it's perfect. But like, how do you write a TNG memorial show and spend most of it having to carefully shoot Patrick Stewart from the shoulders up so you can't see the fact that his arthritis is starting to get to him?
Where's the question, man? How would you do a TNG? How would you do the show that this ultimately is? I'm not saying how would you do Picard season 3. How would you write a love letter to the next generation in a way that is satisfying and carries a story forward? Because I have an idea, but I'm curious if you've got some.
I think the best one I would do would be, it would be a very closed. I don't think I'd even do it. If it has to be a 10-part series, I would do...
Doesn't have to be. Well, whatever you want it to
I
be.
Would do a very close sequence of basically retired Picard is hauled out by Starfleet because they have to send someone to negotiate between various Romulan warlords. And the ship he's on is the Titan with Riker. Maybe they haul him out, and then as he arrives and the Titan being taken by shore, they go, oh, and we've hauled out an expert on Romulan refugees too. And it's Riker and Deanna, who he has been actively avoiding for 20 years. And it's this whole thing of basically, there is this conference. The team are all uncomfortable with each other because basically Picard did the thing he did in season 1 where he walked out and left them to hang on his project. Like, they had all come together to try and save the Romulans. And then when Starfleet had gone, after First Contact or whatever, gone, we're pulling out, he'd resigned and left them to deal with a mess he'd kind of made. I know that you'd have Worf as a representative of the Klingon government who has his own agenda. And you possibly, you know, you bring in people like Rolak, and you know, you'd maybe have the changing twist, of course, where the Dominion, I wouldn't have them be changeling radicals. I would just have it be that the Dominion is trying to get back into Alpha Quadrant politics by causing a complete collapse of the peace deal in former Romulan space. And you know, and you do that and you get all your XPs and your friends and this stuff. That's what I do. But I make 10, maybe 12 episodes, and Picard dies at the end. And whatever he does to die means that peace survives for however long it will. But it means that, you know, that he's given them a fighting chance to live in the proper Kirk style.
Yeah. I think that would be a very satisfying way to do it. You could also, like, I think there's a billion ways you could have done it, but it's just, like, fundamentally not this, where it's just doing the same thing again. You got to evolve the universe and let it be, like, what is... If you're going to do a show that is about legacy, have it focused on Picard, like, what did all my work lead to? What does it mean? Rather than it being like, oh, I get to press my world upon the rest of the universe for all of time. Instead, it would be like, the world's changed, I've changed, but what did everything I did ultimately mean? What did it leave behind for people? Again, that sort of like Deep Space Nine, what we left behind sort of idea, but...
So you're going to love this. Olivia, I'm so sorry. but I'd basically do Visa to Voyages, but from Discovery. I'd literally have the 31st century. I would have basically, it is framed through someone revisiting this era from the 31st century with Discovery, you know, or some of the characters from there, exploring something from this story. I might even basically just rip off something like Sleeping in the Light or something. But I would just literally stand it at the end of it as, you know, Burnham and Saru kind of walk out of the holodeck sort of thing. They just turn the holodeck off and it's out. I would just do a good version of these other Voyagers, mostly just as vengeance for ending.
Have you all, I can't say too much on this podcast, but have you all got the screeners for Star Trek Discovery Season 5 yet?
I have the screeners. I haven't had a chance to watch
them.
John has, can I just say for the record, John has never shared a screener with me. And yeah, I guess you can trust
my
him.
My screeners are
but
not
for
Star Trek screeners. They are Trek screeners. Shout out to Aaron and the guys. You're all great. I'm sorry it took me 4 months to do my Strange New Worlds Builders reviews. I've been busy. I have heard good things. They pulled. I haven't seen it.
I have issues with basically with that. I can't say too much, but all I will say about it is that like the pull that they are pulling from in Star Trek history is interesting. I have issues still with how Star Trek Discovery does action. Like their action sequences are terrible, but the concepts are a lot of fun. So.
Yeah. But what I was going to say. Yeah, it's. It fascinates me on that action point. How much a show with a bunch of old people see has action in it? Not to say that old people can't have action, can't do action, but
okay, TNG fans come for him for that. That was a diss. That was a slight.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, to be fair, that's TNG movie fans because
TNG movies...
I have a pet theory, but after First Contact, we're already in a different timeline because the characters that we see in the Star Trek movies post First Contact are very different to the Star Trek characters we see prior to that. They're
Andy,
all action stars.
Have you just endorsed? You just endorsed Star Trek Coda, right?
Yeah, that's the plot of Star Trek Coda.
You just endorsed the one thing you hate.
Okay, my problem isn't that Coda exists.
We're not
my
doing
problem
this.
Is that Coda destroys the entire literary universe, okay?
Yeah, I get that. But yeah, the whole conceit of that one is that like the First Contact was the split point for the literary universe and the universe of the show, basically.
Which is dumb. Yeah. Just stop worrying about it. Fucking hell. Anyway. Well, the point is they're all old. Why are they running around? To sit them, I'm going to presume that nobody sitting here on a Zoom call here has seen Advice and Consent.
No.
No.
It's a 3-hour film that largely consists of Henry Fonda in a Senate hearing. It's great. It's the first time an American film showed the inside of a gay bar.
Hey.
Which is fascinating in its own way. But that is a film, Advise and Consent. It was the inspiration for the Senate hearing framing in Oppenheimer.
Oh.
It also has Betty White. It's Betty White's first film.
I will have to watch that because that sounds right up my alley.
It's great. it's three hours of communism.
Communism.
But
how dare they?
That's the sort of show Picard should have been, which is a long, a rather dry but interesting deliberation of what the Federation and Star Trek means and what it means in a difficult world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don, they barely want to give Star Trek the money it has now. They're not going to make a dry, sophisticated film for you.
Would it have been cheaper? All you need is the big observation room table.
You just need a big observation room table. And you just let Patrick Stewart talk and cut up. And
nah,
just
they're
made
hiring the craft services for this.
I mean, my pitch for a Star Trek show is like just do Shin Godzilla, but in Star Trek. That's my pitch for a Star Trek show. Where it's like some crisis that happens, and then you have a bunch of people in boardrooms trying to figure out how to utilize the fleet and different ways to deal with it. Like, and ultimately be kind of being about like how does the system of the Federation like uphold its virtues versus like how the system can kind of prevent people being able to enact what those virtues are because of the endless bureaucracy.
Which is fascinating because that's what Picard Season 1 tries to do and sort of half-asses. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek Season 3, Picard is just not interested in interrogating. It has more the Federation's just vibes energy than the original series does.
Well, it's because Star Trek has to be spectacle. Like the Star Trek Picard, the problem with Star Trek Picard season one especially, season two is its own hot sort of mess. But like the problem with Star Trek Picard season one is like they have to be to try to sell Star Trek as something that the whole point with what Paramount's trying to do with Star Trek is they are trying to make it their level of Star Wars because it's the IP that they have to sell their streaming service. And
that's why Beyond was they never followed up with Beyond because it didn't make Avengers money, wasn't it?
Exactly. And it's like it's like they are trying to make Star Trek into a action show to make it much more sellable. And I think the things that I love about Star Trek in its modern era has come out despite it becoming more of a sort of spectacle, like big franchise IP stuff, like episodes like Ad Astra Per Aspera or like Prodigy being this kid show. Like the things that I love about modern Star Trek are what is done in spite of its more action-y focus rather than because of it. But it's just because action sells better. It's spectacle sells better. Nostalgia sells better. And that's why they have shifted it more and more to become this. And it's like, I miss the days. And again, I'm not trying to be like, oh, in the good old days, because I do think modern Star Trek does have elements of this that I really do love. But I do miss the, like, Star Trek is best when you can make it a play. Like, if Star Trek, if you just take a Star Trek script and put it on a theater stage, then you could perform it that way and it works pretty much just as well. That's when I think Star Trek is at its best. And we don't get that as much because there's a lot of spectacle.
I'll say this with Strangely Well, both seasons. I'd say more of them can be done as plays than any other modern Trek show.
Which like, is why I do enjoy Strangely Well, despite my problems with some of its ideological points. But
like, I think Ad Astra Per Aspera could be done as a stage show. It wouldn't be a good one, but it could be. Under the Cloak of War could be. I think the pilot could probably be done as a stage show if you did it, if you just restaged some parts of it.
Mm-hmm. Most of it you could. I mean, the time travel one, like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, you could do as a play. Again, you'd have to like massage some stuff.
I think it's just the Gorn episodes you couldn't do.
Yeah, which is the episodes that I don't like because they're just like, let's just do our Xenomorphs because that's our like, oh look, we can do something cool with this nostalgia alien and make it just the Xenomorphs. And it goes to my problem that I was talking about before. So I think like, yeah, I think the only ones you couldn't really do are the Gorn ones, which are the ones that I kind of hate the most of the whole series.
I think just feeding off of that point as well, I think Star Trek has struggled with serialized storytelling since, you know, in modern era with Discovery. Star Trek has I think part of the power of Star Trek and why it survived so long is it was very easy to just throw on your favorite episode, watch it for 45 minutes, and then, you know, you've had a satisfying story beginning, middle, and end. And outside of maybe Lower Decks and Strange New Worlds, that just doesn't exist anymore. You know, you kind of have to... It's hard to just pick a single favorite episode in isolation without like diving into, you know, part of a entire story. And, you know, I think this was very apparent in earlier Picard seasons where, you know, they had a vague idea of where they wanted to go, but they didn't have an entire story arc set out when they started writing it. And so, you know, they kind of meander around and then they finally kind of, oh shit, we're at the end now. We've got to kind of copy paste feet and giant tentacles and things, which we, you know, we're done. I mean, what I think would have been a much more interesting way to approach Picard and, you know, Strange New Worlds as well is have your overriding story with your beginning, middle, and end, and then you have individual episodes within that. I mean, I think with Strange New Worlds, and I've said this to John before, I think what they should have done with that is it was a one-season show, and it should have been all about Pike coming to terms with his destiny. And once he makes peace with his destiny, that's the end of that show, because that story is then told. I get it, I love the characters and all that, but that was the story. We're now kind of into the world of content. You know, we're just telling more stories for the sake of putting more episodes out there. And I think the same was true of Picard. I think if Picard season one had told the story it told, Picard died at the end sort of thing, with this sense that he'd managed to revitalize this idea of a Federation and Starfleet of being a force for good and, you know, being present in the galaxy rather than being isolationist, that's fine. You know, not everyone would agree with it, but it's a compelling story beginning, middle, and end. But then it didn't happen, and then we had season two. I think another issue here, just to kind of, I'm on a rant now, but basically, I think the writers all have one eye on Twitter or
those
social media.
Fuck, yeah, they should.
How deeply upsetting.
Get off. Go.
But my point, the reason being is, I think Picard season three is a direct response to the feedback from season one of Picard. I don't think it was necessarily
a tale of our own making. This is our fault now, Andy. Fuck you.
I mean, a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm just saying, you know, famously, seasons two and three of Picard were filmed back to back. And I think there was not enough time for them to to change course on season three based on what happened in season two. Picard season three is a direct response to Picard season one and how that was received. And I think it literally is a mirror of that show. You know, it's no new characters outside of Seven and Raffi. All of the story plot points in season one of Picard are gone. They don't matter. We're bringing back all of the original characters. We don't even mention Kestra, which I am so fucking pissed off about, because the Penfei was like the best episode of season one of Picard. And it's just like, they don't even sit in a quiet moment when Riker and Troy are under prison ship and say, I hope Kestra's okay.
Fuck
no.
them kids.
Basically, yeah.
This just goes more something fuck that you them said, kids Andy. Than me.
That was the theme of the entire thing. Fuck those kids.
The thing that you said, Andy, that like, just, I was listening to an interview yesterday with, like, I forget his name, but there was like a famous Hollywood director who's like writing a book, and he made this great point that like kind of goes to what you were talking about, is that so much of storytelling today ends on selling you a cliffhanger or selling you the next thing. I mean, look at Marvel, where it's like everything, every movie is just a pitch for the next movie. It's like, oh, look, we have the Jonathan Majors of it aside. It's like, oh, we have Kang. And now, like, we're setting up Kang for that movie. Oh, look, this movie's setting up this character for the big Avengers. Yeah, right? But it's just, like, everything is setting up the next thing instead of telling the story that it's telling. It's always leaving you with a sense of anxiety. And when we have this, the problem with, like, the storytelling model of Star Trek today with that you see in Star Trek Discovery and Picard and a few others is that every episode leaves you on this feeling of like, but the story's not finished yet, so I can't really analyze. Like, you can't sit there, you can like speculate, like, ooh, I wonder what the mystery box of it all, you can speculate what's coming next, but you
that
can't
fucking
sit...
TED talk that yeah, fucking yeah, TED yeah,
I
know, talk, man.
But you can't sit like when I watch an episode of like Picard or Discovery, like at the end of the episode I can't like be like, what did this episode mean, because I have to wait for the whole season to be able to figure it out. And then when you go back, you kind of like have to, then you can kind of interpret the themes a little bit. And it's very difficult because you're not allowed to rest with anything. And I look at, and that's just so many stories, is that they leave you with this end emotion of anxiety rather than a sense of completion. And I look at Deep Space Nine or even Prodigy, I think is a good example of this now too, where it's like, they have an ongoing storyline that connects throughout its whole season, but each episode like tells its own confined tale that will contribute to the larger whole, but will leave you with a feeling of like, I can look at what this episode was and what it was trying to say and get an idea of what it was doing. And I think Deep Space Nine did that, where like, unless it was like a two-parter episode, like you'd be like, I watched this episode and while it fits into the Dominion War, I can see what this episode said. Even in like those ones where it's like the final part of season seven or the beginning of season six, where there was like multi-episode arcs, each episode had a point that it was like saying at this point in that arc, and yet it would like then it would just go on to the next thing that may follow immediately after, but it made a singular point. And Prodigy's doing that. I mean, look at like especially the back half of Prodigy, where like you have like, oh, we're dealing with them learning about the Federation, we're learning with them like having to escape Janeway and this stuff with the Diviner. Like, you have all of these stories going on, but then you would have like the body swap episode, you would have the episode where they go to this planet where they're doing Star Trek plays. Like there was episodes within that where it's like, I got a resolution on what this theme was. Or like, there's the episode where they go to that one planet where Dahl, spoiler here, like Dahl learns what his backstory origin is, and like that episode is about
all contained.
Mm-hmm.
You could just put one on and show it to a kid and the kid's not gonna go, what happened next?
And I think and it goes to, again, everything that we were talking about. This will be my last thing and I'll put a cap on it, though I have one more rant that I would want to go on about Shaw, but that's a whole thing.
Yeah, we have to end with the Shaw discourse, because I have powerful takes on Shaw discourse.
Tim, this it goes to this thing of like how it's product, and with stories that we see in big franchises, especially today, but I think a lot of movies even do it. Like, we were even talking about this with like Dune Part Two, where like it feels like it's a setup for Dune Messiah, and not resolving the story. It's like, it's always trying to sell you the next thing, and it's always about leaving you on the sense of anxiety for wanting to get the next thing, so that you like want to buy it, so that you can be like, well, I need to know what happens next, so I'm gonna buy the next thing to resolve this feeling of anxiety that I have in my emotions, rather than art being about trying to impart something to you. And it's something that I was even like, sorry, I know I'm ranting about my own stuff, but it's just something I've been thinking about. Like, I'm working on my identities thing, and I want to pitch it as a series that tells an overarching story. But like, and I was even talking to like our producers about it. It's like, well, if you want to pitch this as a pilot for a show, you should leave it on a bigger cliffhanger. And I'm like, no, I want to have this story have an ending. So like, the episode like ends setting up more stories, but there is a definitive, like, this is the emotional point that this made. Like, this, if this ends here, like, this made a point. It says something, and people can talk about it. Like, this is what Jesse was trying to say. And then there's more I could tell with that, but it ends here, and I can be like, this is what this was about. So, and I think more TV shows and movies need to do that nowadays, as opposed to like, and here's the next thing, and here's the next thing.
I mean, just looking at the actual ending of Picard, you know, it ends. I mean, it ends like Return of the King. There's like six endings at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate ending is,
and
it's
the
ending of the Next Generation. It's the ending of the Next Generation. It's them playing
They're
poker.
Back, baby.
You know what
was
the most,
it's either, look at the past, see how the past was cool, or look at the next thing that we can sell you, or sometimes simultaneously both, which is what Picard season three is.
You know what the most annoying ending of that was? The Riker going, let's call it Stardate 1. It's like, no, fuck off. Fuck off. Oh, it's the start of a new era. Like, fuck it is. You've done nothing. You just stopped Space Pearl Harbor. You did jack shit.
Don't try and humble men, John, please.
And also, did they do? Like, they cut a year later and they want to play poker. Fuck me, Jesus. And while we're talking about endings, we have to begin end by talking about Shaw. Now, Olivia, what did you think of Captain Liam Shaw, who everyone has loved because he's a middle-aged white man who looks like he could probably shower every once in a while.
Can I just say, and that people are going to hate me, I can't say I'm going to get cancelled.
No, do it.
I barely noticed.
Like, I only noticed the hype on Twitter. I didn't care. I'm so sorry. I didn't
newest
know.
Newest Icon Star Trek merch. Newest Icon Star Trek merch. It's just a pic. That picture of Ben Wyatt going, I don't get it.
He seemed lovely on Twitter, just for the record.
It's what's his name from Parks and Rec saying, I don't know who Liam Shaw is, and at this point I'm afraid to ask.
Yeah. Literally. And I was like, oh, okay, guys, yeah, I get it. Sure. I'm with you.
Just accept that a middle-aged white man who showers
he
is
was rude.
Listen, I like the idea that Captain Shaw just was a dick who was also very good at his job.
Like anti-seven, something like he was a racist at one point, right? Am I wrong?
Here's my thing. Okay, I will give my mini rant on Shaw. I actually like Shaw until the final choice with him. I actually like he is the standard stock, like boring white dude, like kind of character, and he is able to be the most interesting part of the season, partially because the writers are able to better articulate an arc for a boring white dude. Because that's like all they really couldn't
write what you know.
Yeah, exactly. So like, but I will say, like, that being said, he is interesting in that, like, I can track his emotion. Like, it feels different. Like, he feels like he's like against our main characters. He is pushing back against them, but he at least has, like, I can see where his trauma comes from. Like, him, that whole thing with Wolf 359. And him having been, like, saved just out of pure, like, someone just pointed at him. And a lot of his choices throughout the season are about playing it safe and trying to protect his immediate crew. Because both of those things are pulling from his own trauma. Like, he was put into this dangerous Wolf 359 situation, and he feels like this survivor's guilt. So he's like, I never want to put anyone else in that situation. I want to protect everyone that I'm put in charge of, so that doesn't happen again. And all of his choices and all of his anxieties stem from that. So his dislike of Picard and Riker being these like cowboys who just go out and do things, like, you're putting my crew in danger. The whole thing was like, I don't want to put the Titan in danger to go and rescue them because it would hurt the crew. It would break the rules. Like, all of it is like this man who is like, I follow the rules because that's the way I keep things safe. And I really liked that arc. And then his bigotry towards Seven, it gets complicated by the woke mind virus stuff at the end. But like, his bigotry towards Seven does read to me as like transphobia, where like he dead names Seven. He said he uses her name Annika, like he like forces her to use that name. He has like this consistent like, you're an ex-Borg, so I don't trust you. Like, it reads as like a version of transphobia that I do like, that he comes over the course of the story to like get over it and acknowledge Seven. The problem that I have with Shaw, and I like that his death is like giving her, like saying her name, and it's being like, oh, and I actually really like it, like, For as many times as queer people have to die for a cis dude's story, it was actually really cool to see a cis dude dying for to give an emotional catharsis to a queer-coded character, and especially a woman, and be like, I'm going to die so I can like say 7 of 9, I recognize your identity. I thought that was actually really cool. The thing that I hate is the redeeming moment at the end where it's like, he put her in for a promotion. Like the Tuvok scene, he's like, he put her in for a promotion. He actually trusted her the entire time. I'm like, fuck that. No, he didn't. He was bigoted towards her the entire time, didn't like her at all. So just fuck off with you telling me that like he understood that he saw past his bigotry and was actually recommending her before he died behind the scenes, and he was just realizing he was on it. It's like, no, his arc should have been he got over his bigotry, and I think that that's really great. And don't try and have this like redeeming moment post-death where it was like, oh, but he was actually really cool guy. The whole time. Yeah. Like, I hated that final button.
I'll be honest, I think I just became ambivalent because my introduction to him, I was like, oh, he reminds me of just like any kind of racist guy at work ever. Cool.
Yeah,
and then I became ambivalent from
yeah,
him.
I mean, that's
I know
fair,
he's more nuanced than that. I know there's deeper meaning to what he does, but
he's just a racist, homophobic dude that like gets better, which is like cool. It's not anything revelatory, but that's the arc of him. And okay, at least that's articulated and clear.
My general view on that is, people are really weird about plot arcs where people improve themselves. Especially when they go, like, everybody wants a redemption arc, but then what they get when they get mad about it, right? That's my general view. Like, everyone's like, oh, why isn't everyone like Zuko? It's like, yeah, if that happened now, you'd be really pissy about it. In fact, people still are pissy about it, even though it's earned because he done it overtly atones for what
here's,
he does.
Here's my thing. People love redemption arcs of cis dudes if it's like a person of color or a queer person or a woman. Fuck that, they need to be perfect from the beginning or else we're going to hate them. Look at Burnham. But then if it's like Shaw, well, like, he's got a redemption arc, he's so great, look at him learning. It's like it's we're here for redemption arcs of like white dudes, but we're not here for redemption arcs for other characters. They need to be perfect in the beginning or else they're like ridiculous.
But like I like, there's attractive concept to the idea that Shaw got foisted. Shaw is upset because he's anti-Borg, well, transphobic. And he feels that Seven has been foisted him as a political move. And has to learn through experience that he's wrong and his presumptions are wrong. You know.
We've established that the Federation has a massive blind spot for bigotry against synthetics and cybernetic, you know, individuals.
Which is in the Firewall book too, by the way. I love that.
Oh, excellent.
I'm not saying that what I really wanted from the Seven Shaw relationship is the seminal film In the Heat of the Night. But
you're not saying that.
I'm not saying that. I just largely think that there was a really important point to be made about people self-improving themselves and that there is a way to come back from terrible views.
Oh, I think so too.
But they beamed it by being like, oh, he was never a bigot in the first place. So you've got to suck to earn being good.
But I think that feeds back into what we've been saying earlier. It's about the writers not being confident enough to own their choices. Because as Jesse said, if we'd seen this arc over the course of the show, the thing that I find fascinating about Shaw is we've been on the other side of that throughout all of the Next Generation, where, you know, the bad mole of the week shows up with some random mission and disrupts the status quo. I mean, still to this day, people rant and complain about Jellicoe and Chain of Command because he wanted 4 shifts. How dare you? And it's like this time we're seeing it from the other side with Picard and Riker coming up, and they're going to cause trouble. Everyone knows we're going to cause trouble. And I think what was also fascinating with Shaw, and as John knows, caused me no amount of fucking grief at the time, it's the connection to Wolf 359. Because, you know, I had pretty much finished the book at that point, and everyone who had a screener was going, like, are you going to love this series if we talk about 359? It's like, for fuck's sake, they're going to retcon some stuff, what have you. But the speech he gives was great. It was kind of very much in keeping with what we'd already written. It was beautiful. And look, Todd Stashwick, absolute powerhouse. He delivers that with such passion and such... And the sound design in that moment as well, where we just kind of bring in some of the sound effects from 359. You hear a bit of Locutus there and Red Alert sound.
That sound design was Emmy worthy. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, just throughout this show, I want to just very quickly just say the music, production design, the effects, everything on here, absolutely top notch. It was great. Costume design, I could have done with a few less leather jackets because people seem to like those.
Now you're taking
That's
how we know we're dark, because we got the leather.
Yeah. And why were all the lights fucking turned off?
Because it's sexy, John.
They weren't even on red light running.
John, haven't you realized that that was subtle? Because at the end, when everything's better, the lights are turned up. You see?
Yeah, but it's because it's dark. I still couldn't fucking see anything.
Microdosing the mirror universe.
Going back to what I was saying, the thing with Sean, his arc is, I think this is, as I said, it's the writers just not having the confidence to stick to what they're trying to say. They have to, at the end, say, oh, it wasn't all bad all along. I mean, I wouldn't surprise me at all if that log at the end was a very late addition, because it feels tacked on. It doesn't feel like it's part of the overall story. And, you know, as a result of that, I think it undermines a lot of Shaw's journey and growth as a whole. And I think that is, going back to what I was saying before, it's they have one eye on social media and that instant response. And I think the problem you have there is the people who are going to be responding the loudest are generally the ones with the shittiest takes, because all they want to do is complain and dislike on stuff.
Because the reactor,
It's really important to understand that most people don't understand what you're trying to do. So don't listen to them.
Yeah.
They might like it, they might not. But generally, to stay the course, right? Just if you picked a thing, just keep fucking doing it, and either it'll work or it won't. And if it doesn't work, it's fine. It's art. Everybody's still got paid, unless, of course, this is fucking Batwoman, in which case...
But if you don't have the confidence in your story beat and the story you're trying to tell, how can you expect anyone else to be invested in it and to believe it? Because... you know, if you're going to sit there and say, oh, don't worry, they're not actually dead sort of thing. Oh, we were going to film this thing which shows that they were actually alive. But if we pick us up, we will absolutely do that. Or don't worry, you know, we've got this omnipotent being who's back now and he can just click his fingers and you can have Shaw back. It undermines...
It would be like having five different endings, having a book that ends and there are five... Okay, I'll use an example that will tie Olivia back in, which is, you know that fighter pilot book that I've not finished?
John, I was going to bring it up earlier because you were so happy with killing characters. Then I got a taste of my own medicine.
Here's the point, Olivia. If I wrote that book and killed the characters at the end, and then you flip the page and I had a bit going, well, here's the version if you didn't like the fact I killed them, it would undermine the fact that I killed them. I would be more mad at you, actually.
You wasted my time.
Exactly. It's like, if cried I went, oh, I knew you were going to be mad that I killed them, so I wrote a version where you don't have to deal with that, you'd be really annoyed.
Ultimate people pleasing.
Yeah.
I would like to suffer for a reason at the very least.
Oh, it's like the story I'm working on now is one of the semi-antagonists is a racist London policeman who learns to have a grudging respect for the black main character. And at the end, it's like, basically you expect to have that like classic moment of, you know, I've learned to respect you now. But the policeman basically goes, yeah, well, you're one of the good ones. And the main character goes, I hope I never have to talk to you again. And this policeman who's like our supporting character, he's like, our supporting character goes, yeah, that's fair enough. I can't argue with that.
I love the fact I know exactly who you're talking about as well.
Yeah, it's just like...
Honestly, that should have been how Shaw ended. It's like, you're one of the good Borg. I still hate Borg, but you're one of the good ones. It's like, well, we're on the right path, I guess.
But you know what? That's too subtle for our Star Trek audience. They would be like, woke Shaw, what a king.
You either commit to Shaw doing that, or you commit to giving Shaw the full Zuka, where he just turns out of 7 to 9 and goes, I've been wrong this whole time. I don't expect you to forgive me. But I can't go to my desk without you knowing that I've realized how I was acting was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and even if it is just like, literally, he's like, I know I'm going to die. I can't die without you knowing that I knew I was wrong.
Yeah.
That's still better than him not actually ever being wrong. It's like,
it's this inability. I mean, it goes back to this whole thing. It's like the way Star Trek is positioned is meant to teach, like mostly the, like, older white audience, like, look at how to treat people with respect, but still otherizing them, coding them as alien, coding them as different, and coding them as, like, well, there can also be like the token model minority one, like Spock or Nog or whatever. And like, it's why I love Deep Space Nine so much, because it was like, let's actually make the aliens and the weirdos and the outcasts the ones that we're giving the perspective on, who could then go and judge the Federation, be like, hey, you're the one that made us outcasts. You're the ones that said we're the model minority, whatever. As opposed to like what Star Trek Picard season three is written as, which is like, oh, we need to learn to be, to like see these people as human, and we can totally do that without understanding like the systemic part, like institutional biases that support that like we never want to ever look at. We never want to look at like how the Federation is complicit in this stuff. And like Picard season one at least attempted to be like, look, there is a through line of anti-synthetic bias that we see in Next Generation that would very clearly become codified as law at some point. It's been bubbling for a while, but then would actually become like an institutional thing. Based off of like, look at what these specific like synthetics did. Let's collectively punish like the entire synthetic people. And that season is somewhat ruined at the end by like being like, but you can just be the good ones, and we'll totally get rid of those laws. Like, just don't murder us with your octopus Eldritch horror monsters. And we'll it's be like, you know what? Really. You're cool. Yeah. So that ending undercuts that whole idea, because it's still sort of like, but the system can work, even though we recognize that there's institutional biases. If you just like work within the system, we can fix it and we can do it well. So that season kind
just
of
use your inside
itself.
Voice.
But at least there's an acknowledgement of the institutional bias in season one, whereas in season three, it's just sort of like, nah, these people are rogue people, and we ultimately still just need to protect the Federation without having to recognize any of the fact of the way that Starfleet is got its hands dirty in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, I'm saying this is a final point because we're approaching the 2-hour mark. We might have gone over it, but I do feel sometimes that like Picard season three felt like they were trying to like, well, we've finished off this era of Star Trek, back into the cave for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of...
No, I was going to say, I actually think it was very much the opposite of that. This was very much, as I said before, them very much trying to crank the engine over again. And the day after it's finished airing, there was the talk of a legacy and the continuing story. And I think, look, I've heard things. I will not say them on this podcast, but the decision to name the ship Enterprise was a late call, because it was hoped to carry on into the next show, the next series, to carry things into a spin-off show. And I can't remember any point where a writer or showrunner has been campaigning this publicly for something. I mean, even with Strange New Worlds, that obviously it was a kind of a ground-led movement to do it, but there was no single individual within Paramount saying, you know, if you just keep writing all the letters in sort of thing, you're going to get your Strange New Worlds show. This very much feels like the people behind it want to make the legacy show. Fine, fair enough. But I don't know necessarily that Paramount want to make that show for a variety
so
of reasons.
Which honestly, that's what shocks me, actually, to be frank. Like, I'm like good on Paramount for not wanting to do legacy as it's so pitched. But it's like, because again, I'm not against a show that continues on like Star Trek, but it's a continue like moving forward as opposed to, like you said, legacy. But like, I'm glad that they don't seem to be really interested in this legacy show as it's so pitched as like, and I'm surprised too, because it seems like exactly the mindset of what a studio would want. So I'll give them that. At least.
Are we
like,
officially
I'm not here
out
to
of money?
Them.
Should we be worried?
Oh yeah,
don't
absolutely.
Even want
yes.
Warner Brothers keeps circling Paramount Island, you know, the mountain sort of thing. It's just flying egg island.
Warner
all
Brothers circling
breaks,
Paramount Mountain.
All of the tax breaks.
They're circling it in a B-29 with little boy in it, and they're waiting to get
no,
the
no,
signal
just
from
Baltimore
Bay.
I
just
take
just
everything
think.
Back. Just make Star Trek. I'm sorry.
Now here's the timeline. Think about this, right? Warner Brothers buys Paramount. They instantly announce Star Trek Legacy, and it instantly announces cancellation to get the tax write-off. Instant money. I mean, who's going to lose?
Gene loses.
I hate tax evasion. I hate tax accountants.
This
I think they should be abolished.
Gene's vision. What you should do is just write it, get the theme song, write lyrics to the theme song so you can get the royalties, then cancel it.
Talk a lot about sex. Have a weird Japanese wedding with the woman you had an affair with. on your first
did you
writing
know
job?
Was Gina
that the
Weaver?
Fret ganglia of the Kelpians are actually their erogenous zones as well? That's
no, we're not doing this. We're not
wait, what?
This.
No. Wait. What's their erogenous zones?
No, I was parodying like I was parodying Gene Roddenberry because Gene Roddenberry every time he would write like a doc a, like a memo about a an alien they'd be like but their testicles are actually their ears or whatever.
I'll
so I'm just like if Gene Roddenberry wrote Star Trek Discovery he'd be like so the Kelpians their threat ganglia it's actually their erogenous zones and if you touch it when they feel fear it actually turns to love.
Seems legit, honestly.
Bone.
It seems
like,
canon.
You know Gene Roddenberry would write that.
Yeah.
I think I accept this.
Yeah. It's been 2 hours. What we've learned is we didn't like Picard season 3, which
can I just two points. I just want to have these on the record. Number one, Jack Crusher was more insufferable than Wesley Crusher ever was.
Thank
and number
you.
Two, number two, why the fuck the Titan 8, the whole thing makes no goddamn sense.
Oh, it's
it
all very simple.
On a visceral level.
Which is Terry Metalis wanted to aesthetically make a TOS movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
It's not that difficult. It's like everything about the aesthetics of the show is like he really wanted to make a film from the 2090s.
Andy, they took if you look at Dave Blass's thing, they took the saucer section of the Titan, you see, and then broke it apart and then added another section underneath and added the engines. Very, very simple, very economical, makes total sense of why you would do a start. Like,
then
build
why
a star
do you change the
way.
Number? It's still the same shit. The registry number would remain the same.
They do not know the difference between refit
they task
and flash.
Me. They task me and I shall have them.
Well, it's the same thing as the Stargazer refit. You know, it's the same exact Stargazer from the beginning. That's why it's a refit in season
Why didn't
two.
They just use the Stargazer for the show, incidentally? I mean, they had the bridge there. There's nothing wrong with the ship. Even the captain had gone. Rios had gone back to the past. So, you know,
honestly,
we forgot all about him.
Don't bring it up now.
Oh, no, it's because Terry Metalis
really...
We want
to wind
really,
down.
Terry Metalis really, really wanted to use Bill Krause's model.
Which is a lovely model, to be fair. I love the model. I don't have any problems with that. It's just... Look, I will do a separate... I will do another Derelict episode on registry numbers, okay, at some point. You can all come and just listen to me bitch for 2 hours about why they make no sense.
And instead, though,
bring shots.
Jesse, Andy, where can people find you if they don't know where to find you already, which would be very strange if they're listening to this podcast. But nevertheless...
After you. I mean, we are actually appearing together at the moment.
All right, I'll pack it in.
Well, you can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube. That's where I do my video essay style of stuff. I have a bunch of essays about Star Trek. I'm currently working on one about it's a book essentially about Deep Space Nine. Andy and John have both read parts of it.
Hold on. Pause the whole thing now. Where's my snippet?
If you want a copy, I'm not on Discord with you, but I will send it to you if you want to.
Thanks.
But yeah, I'm working on that and I have a bunch of other essays on there as well. You can also follow me on all the social medias, mainly Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram. And then just because I was talking about it earlier and I'm really excited about it, I am working on a science fiction film called Identities that does star John DeLancey, Q himself, as well as a bunch of other queer and trans folks. It's a fun pitch. Pitch is basically Cube meets Severance is the way I'll share it, meets The Matrix as well. And that'll be available on Nebula, which is the streaming service that I have a bunch of my own videos on and a bunch of other YouTube creators are on as well. And there's also going to be a bunch of other movies and stuff coming there too. And you will can subscribe to Nebula to get that. That is everything.
Hi, and you can find me. I do a podcast called The Great Derelict, where I talk about everything and anything to do with science fiction. It usually rambles on for a couple of hours, but you know, it's a bit of a laugh, a bit of fun. Two of the lovely people here have been part of it. Olivia, I'm coming for you at some point. You can come and be on the episode. I'm also on the social medias. You can usually find me as Andy3E. And much like Terry Metalis, I have also written my own piece of Star Trek fan fiction. But unlike Terry Metalis's one, they didn't pay me to do it. They, in fact, sent lawyers around me and told me I'm not allowed to sell it. But if you are interested
Iconic.
In reading it yourself, you can find it on the Wolf359 Project, or Wolf359Project.com. But I'm told it's good. People liked it. Certainly no one has done a two-hour
Everybody
podcast
Everybody really
debunking
loved the
it.
Appendix at the end. That's what everyone said. The appendix at the end, fucking stellar. But if you want to find us, you can find us at Quit Star Trek Pod on Twitter and Blue Sky and TikTok, so long as the Americans haven't banned it, which they should.
There's a Discord.
There's Discord. We have a Discord channel, which I think there are links to in places. We have a Patreon. Please stop sending us money.
Sean.
Please stop sending us money.
Can't keep living like this.
We will do Patreon content. In fact, I'm announcing our next piece of Patreon content now because I haven't told Olivia this, which is the best way to announce it, which is our third 100th episode will be a live watch of The Visitor for our Patreon listeners to watch.
I've been ready. J-Van, my pain is coming. I don't know why I'm saying that like it's good for me. J-Van, you're finally getting what you want.
Yeah, so we'll be doing that. I will sort details for that and put it on the Patreon and other places. But yeah, thank you so much for most of you coming. Andy will return in Thunderball/An I Quit Star Trek episode very soon. Jesse, as always, you can come back whenever you want.
I will happily do it. I apologize that I rant a whole bunch. So
until next time, everyone, and thank you for listening. Don't make Picard season 3. Just don't make it.
Just go
make something else.
We need to pull a Star Trek New Voyages. Just go back in time, loop around the sun, yeah. Stop Picard.
We're not saving the whales. We're just going to take Terry Metalis and put him somewhere else.
That's how we fix the future.
We're going to Gillian Taylor that motherfucker. Anyway, bye everyone.
Bye.